Hello?
Jello.
Hello.
All right. What's the date today, Sam?
Today is November 15th, 2011.
Punch that in. Poor Four Podcast number 17,
17.
apparently.
God, we just don't shut up.
No, dude, don't insult yourself. Promote the brand.
It's not necessarily an insult.
Bass ringer is off.
What the hell was that automated disaster?
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Welcome to the Port Forward Podcast.
Welcome to the Port Forward Podcast, episode number 17, November 15th, 2011. Ben, how's it going?
What's up, Sam? How's it going, Merrick? How's it going over there, man?
Oh, I'm hanging in.
So, today is November 15th. I remember looking at my email. I think it was just yesterday, and someone had said, "Hey guys, I just went through all the podcasts, and you guys haven't podcasted for like a month." And I looked at that email. I was like, "Yeah, probably we should do something about that."
Yeah,
we are a little bit failing. I'm not gonna
well,
lie.
Well, okay.
But...
So as you guys may have noticed, we have not released a podcast for a little while. This is due to the fact that I was mainly the person producing this podcast, and I have been hustling on my own apps, on basically trying to get my life started up, if you will. And so the podcast is not coming out. You know, don't feel left behind. It's not because, you know, I'm lazy or I'm not doing anything sitting on the couch watching TV. It's because I'm actually trying to promote and be active and get awesome things done. Merrick has been getting tons of awesome things done recently. Isn't that true, Merrick?
It's crazy. Like, I even got a job. Like, that's how much I had to get done. I wasn't sure if I ever would have to get one of those, and I'm a little bit disappointed, but at the same time, I think it's kind of a mixed blessing. So, you know, we'll see how that goes here in a little bit. Today was actually day two, and things are going well, all things considered, and I'm a respectable member of the modern workforce, if you will.
So, what do you do in your job? Can you talk
I'm
about
a,
it?
Yeah, no. Okay. I'm a junior web developer for a small shop called Jabico, and I would actually rate my skill level at the intermediate, but it's spotty. So, you know, it depends on what we're talking about. My stronger suits are server-side scripting and XHTML, CSS. And
don't lose your bash skills, dude. Those will come in handy.
No, I know.
You know
I
mean?
Need to brush up.
You need to
I
brush
totally
up on
need to
bash,
brush up.
Man. That stuff comes back so often.
I seriously even understand that, like, as much as I've used graphical user interfaces, that, like, if you are hardcore in bash, you could pretty much do anything. It's like kind of mind blowing to me. And I want to pick it back up. I've actually slacked off a little since my last class, but I'm doing, you know, web dev stuff for this company, and I'm excited about it because it's kind of the same stuff I've been doing freelance and on my own free time. Now I'm just getting a salary for it, so that's good. And the only downside is I have less free time because it's a smaller shop. The people I'm working with are awesome, and there's, you know, they're not strict about anything. It's pretty much show up when you want, leave when you want, just, you know, put some work in, and I'm excited about it. So
it's going good.
Yeah, it is. It's early on to, like, say, you know, obviously today was day two, like, in 90
nice.
Days or 120 days, I'll have a, you know, a report of how things are going. But I did, instead of just sitting around, like, whereas an example, if you might have gone to work for a larger corporation, the beginning of work is, like, tedious and boring, where they just have you fill out a bunch
of
paperwork.
It's like a slow start. It's like you're just chilling and like you kind of like whatever.
They might even give you a documentation or a manual and be like, just go ahead and read that. And you're like, wait, what? But I sat down and they're like, okay, so we have this client. They want to migrate their site from Drupal 5 to Drupal 7. Get on it. And I'm like, all right, cool. Let me just go ahead and learn Drupal real quick and I'll
nice.
Jump in that.
Dude,
so,
do you want me to tell a Drupal story maybe a little bit later? We're going to talk about that
a little
bit.
Fill me in on that one.
Okay, we'll do that. And so it's going good. You know, I had a quick comment about what you just said. I worked at a job once, and it was just an internship, and I kind of got there, and they were like, so, you know, you can kind of come in when you want and leave when you want, but if there's work to be done, you're staying here all night. Like, that was kind of the subtone. Like, you better meet your fucking deadline, but you can leave whenever you want.
Yeah, these guys are laid back, and it's part of Santa Cruz, too. If anyone's ever been to Santa Cruz or lived in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, it's true.
Things are a little different here, you know.
Yeah.
And Sam, what have you been up to?
Got certified in the forensic stuff.
Would you care to elaborate on that a little bit?
You went to Vegas for that, right?
Yeah. You know, like, they had a couple of choices of places, and I decided not to go to Maryland.
Or Florida.
Yeah, they had Maryland, like some place in Colorado. I was like, I think I'll go with the Vegas one. So
you're pretty much like Dexter, but digital, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Sweet.
So just keep elaborating. So it was a IP InfoSec, right? Basically training, right?
Right.
And you learned about everything from what hardware and connectors look like all the way into how to do postmortem, like pulling RAM, like what else, like what did they cover in a brief synopsis?
In a brief synopsis, they essentially cover everything from how to deal with an incident. So if you're the first responder, like the proper ways you handle it to ensure evidence collection is you know, dealt with in a way that can't be challenged later by the prosecution or defense in a case. And, you know, it ties in really nicely with the legal work that I do all the time.
So you make sure you're legally sound when you do your operations, right?
Yeah.
Everything's tight.
So the trial wouldn't play out like O.J. Simpson's, essentially, is what you're getting
at. Yeah. You want to not have stuff get thrown out because you fucked up like a rookie.
Gotcha.
And as far as the technical stuff goes, I was really disappointed. Ben and I had an epic all-night session, which I still plan on editing.
We were basically reviewing before you went out to fly out and take the class and then test, and we basically just kind of covered some questions that Sam had. You had like highlighted every question you had in the book, or you wrote it down, and then you had like the page number, and it was a very organized approach to learning, I'll say that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's...
It was very like, this is what I need to know, this is what I don't know.
Right. I don't know. I thought it was pretty good. I learned a whole bunch of stuff.
And recorded it all, and Sam still has not edited it. So actually, part of this big famine of the Port Forward podcast that you guys out there are experiencing is due to Sam not cutting up that audio, because I was totally ready to produce that in a 2 to 4 weeks between the last
we should clarify that. I mean, you did mention it before, but you are the producer, editor, and all the other ers of the show. Sam and I just kind of... mentally masturbate on the microphone with you, so because you have to do all that stuff.
Well, this time it's my fault.
The fact that you started, like, you know, all this extra, you took on all this extra work, you know, not only just at work but on the side, and you know, you're trying to take over the world, which I love because I'm trying to also. Essentially, what it comes down to is I need to help out with the podcast, which is sad but true. So,
well,
I'm
you
now
know,
going
we'll
to
get
be,
you help, you know, get you started on all the software you need.
And what hopefully this means for our listeners is we're going to get some kind of regular production schedule going, such that, you know, I was thinking bi-monthly, every 2 weeks would be great, and that way, you know, we could have lots of time for everything and still push out a podcast.
So wait, are you trying to say that I can now mentally masturbate and then you can do all the hard work?
We'll do kind of a group masturbation.
In the session, in the 2-hour session?
Yeah.
Okay, all
maybe
right.
Maybe like a virtual circle jerk, if you will.
Okay, okay.
Thanks for the imagery.
Thanks for derailing that. Eric. Yeah, thanks for derailing everything with that. But yeah, okay.
That's good.
We're going to get into some
feedback?
So
let's see. That's what Sam's been up to. And
Well, Sam, any final thoughts on your, you know...
Yeah.
On your thing?
That particular school, the one that I use, InfoSec, those guys are not hardcore enough.
They kind of let you down.
They really did. I was fully...
You paid a lot of money to go, like over in the grant, you know, in the numbers of grands, and they basically let you down.
So what's the next level? I mean, where would you go to take it to the next level?
Well, where does he take it? How do you first off fix the first problem, Sam? What do you do?
Which first problem?
Merrick says take it to the next level, but how do you fix the first level?
You mean the
what do you do after you pay a bunch of money to not get...
Well, I filed a Better Business Bureau complaint. Usually the first thing I do, which just lays everything out as a baseline. And then, you know, most companies will cave when they get a Better Business Bureau complaint just because it comes, it's all official, and, you know, they just go, okay, whatever you want here, just, like, go away. But, you know, this is a lot of money, so I'm probably just going to end up suing them for it because...
That's what small claims is for, though, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, nice. It's not...
I'm stoked that, like, you know how to do that just because, I don't know, on the random occasion everyone gets ripped off, that's what they want to do, but you have to decide if you want to put the effort into it or not.
Dude, yeah. I totally get all Jewish about it. They don't get away with it.
Dude, well, I mean, you know, what was... The one example that you gave me was the question about the hard drive and the pins being wrong. You want to tell that story, Sam?
Oh,
just to sum up their incompetence?
Yeah, well, hard drive has 39 pins. To it,
an IDE
hard drive, and so in the class they like put up the slide which said like 29 pins, and I was like, yeah, except that it doesn't, because you know, it just sounded like not that many. So, and he's like, yeah, it does, and I was like, oh god. So I take out my iPhone and type IDE, like, so I started counting them. I'm like, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, and you know, I counted it and it was like 40 minus one, you know, so I'm like, yeah, it's got 39 pins.
Blank.
And he's like, oh. Yeah, I thought it was 29. I'm like, okay, so when I went to take the test, which is by the IA something certification board or whatever, has like all these choices, 128 pins, 10 pins, 5 pins, and 29 pins. So, you know, I have to choose 29 pins, but I'm like, for God's sakes. Other questions?
So 39 was not an option, right?
Yeah, so it's like, it's this double incompetence. The review board is incompetent. They also have like lots of questions that have like double answers, and like,
that's weird.
Double of the answers are correct, so I'm like, okay, if I choose A or B, like, one of them's going to be wrong. And just like, like, no confidence. So whenever someone says they're certified, that's just some bullshit. You have to, like...
Well, at least with that certification, right?
Yeah, there is another one. The CHFI one is way more hardcore. That thing...
So that's the next level, then?
Yeah, that one was administered by EC Council, and from what I can tell, based on their questions that they ask, plus... If you go to their website and just look at the courses they have, the outlines for their courses seem to be really in-depth and pretty fucking hardcore. So I would definitely... I'm going to go with that company next time I ever pay for
it. Take your
anything.
Money out of the first company and reinvest in the second company. Your degree deserves to be an investment for you that you can use, you know?
Yeah, for
definitely.
Sure. So I would go with that. Those questions were...
And when you get there, you can give them the hard drive test and see if they pass.
Definitely. But yeah, that's just one example. There's other stuff too. For example, back in the day with Windows 95, with RAM slack. You know how a sector can only hold 512 bytes. So when you start to fill data in a sector, if you only needed 12 bytes, for example, what the operating system used to do, Windows 95, is it would just fill the remaining. The remaining
with
bytes
RAM,
with...
Because it was just in RAM, so it would just dump it, the whole thing, to disk.
Yeah, it would just
it
take
worry
something,
about what was allocated
it.
Or not allocated in that space.
Right. It would just say, here, take some stuff. Obviously, that became a security concern for companies and whatever, because they might have passwords in memory or something. So it would be a bad idea.
You know what? It was probably just a function that didn't let you specify less than, what was it, 512 bytes,
yeah.
You said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if the function API doesn't let you specify it, that means you'd have to do extra work to zero it out before you sent it down
right.
to that call. And you're like, well, let's just pass the pointer and whatever's passed it in memory. Let's just do that.
Right, which I imagine was easier, like you said. So
yeah.
They changed, you know, because that became a security problem, and I guess security professionals in the mid-90s recognized that, Microsoft changed it for Windows 95B. And so in the class... The instructor was trying to tell me that the operating system still does that. And I've just done a lot of forensic research on my own, so that's the only reason why I know that. I just happened to randomly know that that was changed in Windows 95B. And so I kept having to be that guy who was just like, no, you're wrong. And he's just like, no, actually, I'm right.
Yep,
I'm like,
hi,
no.
Hi, me again, Sam in the back. Yeah, no, you have no idea what you're talking about.
And I really didn't want to have to be that guy, but ended up being that guy.
No, it's good because it's better. If you would have kept quiet, then all the people who thought they were learning good information would have been, you know, sent out in the world of retardation. So it's good. Always speak up, and you don't have to be a dick about it because that's how people are going to get defensive. But if you come on somewhat friendly and like, oh, are you sure it's not this way? Or wait, what? This is what I heard, or I thought it was.
Right.
You'd be surprised. Most people will be receptive to that, and some people are just going to be like, oh no, this is the right way, or I'm right. And then you can just be like, right, whatever, dude. Keep thinking that.
Distraction depth. Are you ready for this, guys?
Ready.
Let's do it.
So when Sam was telling his story, I was totally thinking about it. Now I totally forget my distraction depth. How could I do that? We're distracting our people.
Hey, that means we're at ADD depth one.
Sure.
It's awesome. Sam was telling a story. All right, Sam, tell your whole story again.
Did it have anything to do with RAM Slack?
Yeah, it had everything to do with RAM Slack. Oh. It was basically... Oh, yeah, I remember. So the distraction depth is, how do you think they detected RAM Slack on the disk, Sam?
Jeez. I guess somebody must have done a forensic analysis of a system, and then it didn't...
I would say, to make it even more in more simple terms, someone did a diff of two different disks with the same file writes and reads on it.
Oh.
And they were like, that's really funny that these diffs are coming out different every time, right?
Right.
Mm.
I bet you that was probably what... And then they looked and they said, oh, it's just in these special areas and it doesn't actually affect the files. It's just in those Slack areas, right?
But then
instead of writing zeros or making
born.
It smart enough to know how to, like, you know, put a dictionary in, put something useful or something that's not programmatic, but specifically a program, like unrandom, right? So,
right, mm-hmm. You're right. Most operating systems, I guess all of them these days, they just write zeros. At least Microsoft, all versions of Windows since then, they just put zeros. So,
right.
So whenever you're writing new data to a disk, you can see, when you look at the drive forensically, you can see where the zeros end, and then the actual file slack is there, or the new file begins. You can just see it there. And I've looked
very
at that,
cool.
And that's why I know that it's not RAM. There's no RAM dump data being dumped anymore. So
nice. So I guess we caught up on Merrick, we caught up on Sam. I don't know if we caught up that much on me.
No, you need to fill us in on why.
So I've been basically, I started working with this startup on my free time, and I don't really want to go into details as to what it is, but it's been some, you know, fun. I don't know, it's like really early stage, so we don't have funding yet, but we're trying to collect people and trying to, you know, take something off the ground, right? So that's been really fun.
Well,
also,
without telling us what it is, like, tell us, like, maybe how it's built or what it's built with or what
so
you're
it's
working
built,
on.
Okay, so it's built on iOS, and it needs to communicate with a server. And someone, an advisor to the startup, already has some code that'll go well that's written in Java on the server. I'm not a huge Java guy, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to hate on the language or whatever. Java on the server has very good history of running well, and you don't have buffer overruns, which is so common with C. I mean, you don't have that with other languages too, but Java's it's pretty legit. As opposed to the kind of Java that Sam might hate, which is client-side Java,
right,
which is running in a bajillion different environments and is totally awful.
Mm.
But
right, Sam?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, yeah. I know that Java on a server has got to be different.
So also, I've been doing iOS for them, and I've been doing iOS for, of course, Real Money Slots, which Sam and I have been working on for a while. Mm-hmm. Sam and I had a graphics session to make, basically clean up the UI, or not clean up the UI, sorry, make a UI that exists in the first place. And, you know.
I had to get rid of your coin, Merrick. I'm really sorry. That was a cool coin.
Yeah, that's okay. It only took me like a half hour, I think.
Dude, what did you even use to make that coin? Like, honestly, if someone said,
yeah,
please make this coin, I'll pay you $100, go. It would take me, like, a long time to make that. I'd be like, what?
Because, Sam, I was thinking about this. You are only a Photoshop guy. You're not an Illustrator guy. And you don't have a Wacom tab. You don't use a pen like you should. There's a different genre of being a graphic designer.
And that's the thing, too. I'm not even, like, the graphic designer. I'm, like, unfortunately just comfortable enough in the programs to get shit done. Like, if you use this stuff every day in your place of work, I'm sure you would learn so many things where you could just, like, rip graphics out like crazy. Like, I will stumble upon things in both Illustrator and Photoshop. I'm like, oh wow, that's a huge time saver. Too bad I didn't ever know about that in my whole life until now. And just for instance, in this class I'm taking right now, it's like advanced Photoshop, even though half the freaking assignments are in Illustrator. That's interesting. Didn't really think about that till just now either.
Well, they cross sort of back and forth. Like the thing,
yeah,
the coin that you made, for example,
stuff going back and
in
forth.
At the academy where I got my degree in animation and visual effects, they saw just a huge amount of that stuff, and it crossed over with After Effects, and, you know, there's a whole huge blur between all of those different environments, and so I can use Illustrator and I can use the pen. I don't know what it is. It just really bugs me. It's all
slow. The pen's
slow
actually
and,
pretty important. You should. Yeah. That's a huge thing.
It is.
It's really weird at first. It's not very intuitive. And when you were like, a good practice, for instance, would be to like trace a palm tree with it or something. That would brush up on your old pen skills. But what I was saying before is the teacher was like, oh, yeah, and this is, you know, the 4 hours to 6 hours of work that's required to add some, you know, 3D depth to this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, so this 3D rotate revolve thing that takes me four clicks and makes it look perfect, is it bad because why? And it's like, God damn it. So I don't know. That's, there's always going to be a gap between education and what's going on in the industry, and I'm recently become frustrated with some of that. Not to say you can't find excellent educational institutions where they're teaching, you know, current best practices, but I'm not exposed to a lot of that, so I'm better learning on my own.
Yeah,
crazily enough,
as I just proved to myself, there's
pretty much,
really nothing wrong
there
with
too. Totally different field, and you know, same conclusion. So there you go.
Yeah, it's disappointing. Basically, my experience with that organization was exactly what I was afraid of having.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. The good news is you at least found someone who looks legit and you can actually go and learn some good shit in, so that's good.
But Sam, but you know, bringing us back to the subject, Sam did some amazing Photoshop work. He
nice.
Has some very good compositing skills, and the little lights on the slot machines animate, Merrick. You would love it. I need to show you, man. It looks really legit.
Yeah, I need to see it.
And basically, there's some more work to be done on that. But as I was doing this iOS programming, I was like, oh, wow, I really wish I had this module. Or, oh, I really wish I had this module that I could use to just drop into my iOS program. So I have uploaded a couple things onto GitHub, if you guys are familiar with GitHub, Merrick, Sam.
I think it's a fast food joint, right, in Southern California?
Yes, totally. The first thing I want to tell you guys about that I've uploaded in the gap, of course, since the last podcast, is a project called iOS Queue Object. And basically, it's very few lines, and it allows you to have a queue, a first-in, first-out queue. Basically what that means is that if you have people in a line, you put someone in the line, and the next three or four people you put behind that person in line, they're standing, and they come out of the line last. And then the person at the head, you can remove things from the head, and then, you know, that'll be the first ones out because they were the first ones in the line. And it just lets you hold any kind of object you want and just put them in a queue and take them out. It's really cool.
Nice.
Yeah, it sounds pretty useful for all sorts of various things that I can't think of right now.
Another thing that I want to put into GitHub but I haven't is a state machine. I've written basically what I think is my best attempt at a state machine on iOS. It ticks through its states. It has messages in and messages out. It's using Grand Central Dispatch, for those of you who know what that is. It's like a messaging thing that iOS has. I haven't put that in GitHub yet, but I'm working on it. Another thing I have on GitHub is, remember we went to the HTML5 talk at Drop Talks, guys?
I like that. That was a good one.
He was talking about WebSockets, and I kind of got into that for a separate reason. And so I have – this is actually a PHP script, Merrick, but It opens a new port, and you can do WebSockets to that new port. And the JavaScript is, like, super simple. It's, like, 20 lines of JavaScript or 10 lines of JavaScript to open a connection to this PHP server.
Nice.
It's a little chat – program. And the whole point of it is that you open the connection, and then you just hold it open. So between each chat message back and forth, you don't ever close in the connection and reopening it. So the chats come in real quick because you don't have, like, that overhead or whatever.
I'm jealous. I actually can't wait to, like, get hands-on with some of that stuff. I will go to some of these conferences, these tech things, and I'll be like, oh, that sounds cool. And then it's like you kind of have to have a reason or the time to just sit down and learn how it works. And that's awesome. You had an excuse to dive into it. So
I basically someone had one that was working online from an older standard, and I just made it, I changed it to work with the new standard. And
nice.
Someone's following it, so someone cares about that.
That's cool.
I'm not claiming rights to it, but, you know, I modified it.
Well, whatever, that's what open source is all about.
The next thing I have is a JSON interpreter for a C compiler/something that runs C, I guess, CPU. Yeah. There was already a JSON C library out there, but I needed it to run a 16-bit microcontroller. So I modified all of the assumptions where they assume that ints are 32 bits and not 16, and where it fucks it all up. And so basically I was modifying it, and since they added unit tests with it, Merrick, I could just run the unit test to see if my modifications worked or not. And if all the tests pass, and I'll write some tests later, like whatever, you know.
God, I'm continually fantasizing about those, even though I haven't had a chance to, like, start using them yet.
Yeah, they're pretty legit.
Ugh. No, seriously, it's built into Drupal, so I don't know that. I'm going to find out in the coming weeks if we're utilizing those or not, and hopefully we are. That's all I can say about that.
Very nice. And then the last thing I have is a project that I also found from somewhere on the internet and changed up. For work, we need to be able to calculate an SHA-1 hash. It's just like a flavor of hash. It's pretty legit. And for whatever reason, I needed to be in the fourth language, because that's what our kernel runs in, is the fourth language. So I found an example online, but once again, it was 32-bit, so I had to convert this down to 16-bit. And let me tell you, fourth is, I don't know, not a fan of fourth. It's a crappy language. I'm just going to say that out there. I would say that fourth is a write-only language, not read, just write.
Because, so clarify that.
So basically, have you seen those calculators, like HP calculators, where the numbers go in a different order? Like 5, 5 plus would be, on a normal calculator, you'd say 5 plus 5. Have you seen anything like that? Any weird calculators that look like that?
No.
Basically, the reason that works is Sam, if you're with us, is you put things on a stack. So you put 5 on the stack, you put 5 on the stack, okay, which is a first in, last out stack, by the way. And then when you put the plus, it pops the two things off the stack, so it takes those two fives and then adds them. So basically everything you're doing is being put on the stack and taken off the stack. So a number will put something on, a function will put something on, and then functions will also take things off the stack. That's like their input and output parameters. Anyways, the point is that the numbers, variables don't stay in variable names often. I mean, they can, but they don't often stay at a variable name. Usually they're just sitting on the stack, and then you multiply it by 2, and then you multiply it by 10, and then the number's still just sitting there, and it's like, well, what do I do with this number? So since the numbers are disconnected from variable names, it makes it super hard to figure out what's happening at all.
That's
so complicated.
Weird. So how did this language come about? Is it just archaic? I don't know the history.
It's really old. So basically it's meant more for microcontrollers, or at least that's how it's been used very well today. But it does have one feature that C does not have, which makes it very unique. And that is that the language has two stacks, one for data and one for program location or whatever. So in C, Merrick, when you make a function call, basically you're compiling an assembly that says jump to this location. That's your assembly call, right? Before you jump to the location, you have to prepare the things you're passing into the function, right? Like you're giving it parameters or whatever, right? So basically you say, I'm putting these numbers on the stack and giving it to the function, and I'm putting the function address, and then I'm jumping. And what that means is that the data and the address of the function are in the same stack. Fourth is different than that because it has a separate stack for data and a separate stack for variables. So when you jump to a function, you automatically know where you came from, basically because you just have to look back one space in memory. Basically because the data types are separated, you can tell very easily what is data and what is an address.
Interesting. So in certain cases, this would even be faster too.
It is. It's usually faster for low-level stuff. Okay. But then it has other drawbacks and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But it's very complicated language. But if you get used to it, you know.
And so you were exposed to this through your work or just
through
recently?
Through my work.
All
the kernels that we make at my work on those microcontrollers I explained to you guys, I don't know, some previous episode, they all run with a fourth assembly or a fourth kernel, fourth and assembly, basically operating system. And then my job is to maintain a C compiler that will run on top of that fourth kernel. And so a lot of calls that are being made are being made into the fourth kernel.
Interesting.
And you remember how I was talking about the different order of calling functions and things like that? If you want to make a call from C into fourth, you have to basically mangle the data and then call it in. And it's the same way from fourth to C. They have special conversions to basically say, this is how we call a function in this language.
Sure.
You have to put things on the data stack. You know, you have to put your data and return on the data stack, or you separate them out. It's very interesting.
Have you tried to become sort of a master of this, or are you trying to learn just
the minimum?
Well,
it's a part of a requirement of my job. I've been focusing on the C, and I know a lot of embedded C, which means, like, randomly you'll just put in a hex value and write an address to that hex value. Like, you just make a pointer to a random hex value, and then you write some value. And then if you come back later, you're like, why did I just write something to that's not even a variable, it's just an address? Well, that's because you're doing embedded C, because everything is memory mapped, everything is like really raw, and you know, it's all the things are there in memory. So, you know, that's kind of what I've been getting really good at. But fourth is also good at those low level things. So kind of by design of the things that I do at my work, Sam, I'll try to avoid fourth.
Right.
But like my job is to work on the C compiler. So when they interface, I have to get all hardcore and figure out how fourth works, et cetera, back and forth.
That doesn't
sound... backing up, what's
interesting? I'm just saying that sounds like something you try to avoid as much as possible.
Dude, it's hardcore. So back to what I was explaining was this SHA-1 function. I needed it in the fourth language. This is up on my GitHub. Basically, I sent a message to the guy that owned the website, and he was all interested in it. I was like, look, I modified your code. I just put it online. And he had like some Russian site. He's like, oh, I'll send it to the forum members or whatever. He's like, I enjoy learning about your language and stuff like that. So it was really cool that I was like able to basically contribute to an open source project.
That is, I'm a little bit jealous of that because I definitely see the first impression to open source is, well, you know, what is the advantage of me putting effort into that? But then if you think about it, there is actually a lot of advantages because you would learn many things just by, you know, going outside of your realm and working on something new. And at the same time, when there's a community of people that are willing to put their free time and effort into something, there's like, you know, this collaboration that happens that's different than, you know, a conventional workplace scenario, for instance.
Let me mention, when I say, you know, contributing to an open source project, let me rephrase that and say that I found this on some random ass forth.org.ru site, and it was a Google cache of a page, which was originally stored on something else. It was originally stored on earthlink.net. So
God.
Then it had been mirrored to this Forth site. So Earthlink guys took a Google cache, and then Forth.ru took a mirror of the Earthlink guys.
That's amazing.
And that's where I found the data. So I was like, this needs to be put in a source control. We need to get control on this fucking thing.
Dude, I'm surprised you didn't find it in GeoCities after that history lesson there. That's madness.
But,
that's pretty cool, though.
Distraction dev, dude. So I learned everything about how SHA hash 1 works. I looked at every piece of data as I went through every fucking step of the way. It's really, really cool the way they do it.
Nice.
Would you mind explaining some of that a little bit? Because I have to use
So basically the first thing that you do is you have a output. You've got the output buffer, which is so many bytes of output, and then you have your message buffer. And so if you just want to cache, let's say, A or B or, you know, hello or whatever, Sam, mm-hmm. you put it in the message buffer, and then basically what they do is they fold the numbers back over on themselves, if that makes sense, Sam. So you multiply the numbers times themselves, and then you shift it to the left, and then multiply it times the next one, and shift it and multiply. And because all the math rolls over as it gets bigger and bigger, it just rolls over, the number just kind of gets scrambled.
So, like, are you taking the number, is that the hex value of H, for example, in hello?
So the hex value of H, right,
okay.
Plus the hex value of E, okay, because let's say because these are 16-bit multiplies. So you take two of the things,
mm-hmm.
okay, multiply them times the next two things, mm-hmm. You know, and it together with the last thing, and then, you know, inverted with this, and then done to this, and then XORed against this, and XORed against that, you know.
Yeah.
And then basically it's called mix, in this function it's called mix, and it has separate runs. So it says runs 0 to 20, 20 to 40, you know, 40 to 60, 60 to 80, 80 to 100. And that's just to chew up your data.
Gotcha.
And then it has to be what was the memory padding you were saying for the file system? What was that called again? We were talking about where it dumps the memory to disk?
Oh, RAM slack?
RAM slack.
Yeah.
Right. So it basically if your message is shorter than it's shorter than 512 bits, Sam, mm-hmm. then you have to fill it in order to get an entire block.
Right.
Okay.
So what does it use to fill it in?
It uses basically it just hashes. Let me think.
Well, it's so scrambled.
I think it hashes zeros onto it. No, let's see. What does it say? Update final. So you pad. This is what you do. You pad so the size is 64 bits less mm-hmm. than what you want. And you pad by adding in, I think, FFs and then spaces or something like that. And then for those final 64 bits, you take a count of your entire message and fill it in as the last 64-bit number.
Ah, clever.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you hash it one last time.
Nice.
You make it fold over itself one last time. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, that's pretty good. So do you know when SHA-3 is due to come out?
I don't know. One last thing that it exhibits is it exhibits the, I want to say, cascade effect. Let me double check this so I get this totally straight.
Wait, Sam, while he's checking that, how do you even know about 3 and what is that just like the
Oh, it's proposed.
Newer,
it's proposed.
Safer,
yeah,
better?
It's proposed. It's, you know, contenders, people like compete to get their thing accepted or whatever. I don't really know how it works since I obviously am not smarter than those guys.
Mm.
but
maybe you are, and maybe they're the ones who made it. All right,
I got
they
it.
Thought hard drives had 29 pins.
So this thing that I was trying to remember is called the avalanche effect, and basically what that means is that if you change one or two bits, a bunch of bits change on the output. Like, I think if you change one bit, half the bits change on your output. If you change two bits, then probably all of them or 75% of them change or whatever. Whereas with if you were just doing a modulo and you changed one bit, chances are the output would also change by just one bit, not
50%. Yeah, which would indicate the weakness of that hash.
Right, exactly. So the avalanche effect basically folds it over on top of itself. You know, if you imagine, let's say, you know, a piece of meat or whatever, and you put it in a meat grinder, it might fold it over and over and over 40 times or whatever. So if you change a little bit, if you put a spot of ink on that meat, like a spot of red dye or black dye, then it would come out folded over totally different depending on which place of the meat you put it on. Like, I don't know. You know, the final product is totally different.
Mildly intriguing analogy you went with there.
That's pretty good.
Dude, I've always had a meat grinder, as my prime analogy for hashes.
Speaking of Dexter. That's funny. All right, so that's what you've been up to, which is awesome because...
I've been basically putting stuff on GitHub. So, I mean, if you guys want some PHP, Merrick, I'll send it to you. You can take
a look
at
your description versus, like, our descriptions of what we've been busy with, you sound like you get way more shit done than we do. I'm, like, jealous. I don't know. Maybe I just need to talk more about what I do. Like, this morning I got in the shower and I was naked and I got all wet and I put soap on me. And, oh, wait, that sucks. Never mind. No, I'm impressed. Seriously, Ben, that's awesome. You've been doing all that shit. Like, I'm genuinely impressed that you... I'm busy with the... fewer amount of startups I have and the job I have. Granted, I'm new at it and you're comfortable in your job, which is not to say you don't put work in there, obviously, due to the madness you just described between C and fourth, which still don't even remotely understand. No, I'm just kidding. But I never even would have imagined, you know, something like that having to happen, except for like when you were like, oh, and this is why we need it. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. But at the same time, if someone's like, oh, well, how would you use C and fourth together? I'd be like, what? Fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, what's happening? Yeah, there was a lot of research put into my bosses into that kind of stuff. So, I mean, basically, like you said, I've been hustling real hard. I've been trying I've been increasing my fucking knowledge base, my database, and my brain by trying to learn as much shit as I possibly can. And I basically also have been on Twitter. If you want to follow the show, the Twitter address is portfwdpodcast. And I spend a lot of time looking for people's questions on Twitter and trying to answer them. I'll tweet back to them about technology, about Zen Server, about Linux, about, you know, file systems, Sam, like you and your slacking thing or whatever. So you guys should definitely, you know, if you want a quick way to contact the show, you can come on there. I'm basically will be the person you'll be talking to. And, you know, just ask me some random question about something you're doing or tell me about the cool server you just built. Merrick, what's your Twitter address?
Mine, I believe, is @fastc4, F-A-S-T, Charlie 4, or Foxtrot Alpha Sierra Tango Charlie 4, and that comes from my license plate, Fast C4. And you might be thinking, what? C4, that's an explosive. Isn't that pretty fast anyway? No, I'm talking about a fourth generation Corvette, of course. But,
Sam, what's your handle?
Variable Gigahertz, GHZ.
Want to give it to that to us in the military alphabet?
So do you mean GHZ. Variable gigahertz and then GHZ after that whole thing?
No. Just variable GHZ. Variable gigahertz.
Oh, okay. Because there could be a little confusion.
But I look at the search terms that people use to get to variable gigahertz, and I see it typed really funny. Like, yeah. However you butcher it these days, it'll always get to
variable GHZ. Google's pretty amazing like that. Google does a good job. You got to give credit where it's due.
Yeah. We got a donation.
Oh, yes.
Well, wait, real quick. We got to tell people what it was. It's variable, and then golf, hotel, Zulu.
Yes.
That's what it is.
That's variable. Regular variable spelling, golf, hotel, Zulu. You know, there was another letter that the other day, I could not think of, and it was killing me. It was like, someone's like, oh, do you know the alphabet? I'm like, haha, and I went through it, and I'm like, except for
that one.
I'm rusty. And I was like, god damn it. And I don't remember what it was now, but anyway, that's funny. So, that's
okay,
good. So those are our Twitter handles. We're caught up on our personal lives, and
that we're just been done dicking around, usually we start with the feedback, but I figured that we have been off the podcast, so we'll just talk about what we've been doing. I'll talk about how hardcore I've been, you know, whatever.
Way to toot your own horn there.
You're welcome. So let's go ahead and start the show. The real show, I guess. I don't know. The part where we talk to you guys and you give us feedback. We got a donation, Sam, not to cut you off, I'm sorry, earlier, but we got a donation from Peter C., and he donated $50 to us. It was kind of been a while because he donated right after the last show. But we wanted to thank him very much. It makes the show possible. It makes it, you know, our effort worth it. Not that we don't love talking to you guys, but it's nice to have, you know, sustaining
without these
the losses.
Little amounts, it would be that much harder for Ben to enjoy strippers and cocaine at the current level he does. So
yes, exactly.
But the priceless part was how Peter included a little message, a little quote that I hold dear, and it's the quote is a donation to the Merrick Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. And this makes me very happy because one day down the road when I am able to enact Homeless Island and I am able to ferry the unfortunates of our society there, I can drop them off and let them be in their own little Lord of the Flies environment and have them just live their lives to the fullest, whether that means survival or not. I'll let them take care of that. And in the some inconspicuous or maybe conspicuous place on the island, there'll be a small plaque with the first donor's name, Peter C., and it says, thanks for everything. And it'll be like maybe that and a few other clues. I'm not going to go full Lost. I don't want like anyone to actually escape from the island or like a TV show to be made after it, but there will definitely be an island full of homeless people at a minimum. So thanks for that, Peter, and I'm going to keep you in mind when we're setting this all up. I'll even, you know, since you're VIP donor one, you can even provide input with you want or help me tag and bag them. Either way, I don't care.
We got additional feedback from Mike Shaw. Basically, Mike Shaw is using us to just send like links that he thinks are super cool. Just like, oh, there's a cool link I'm sending to the podcast, which is amazing. That means that his subconscious is now feeding information directly into our inbox. So you should be like Mike Shaw and send us emails, which is packets@portforwardpodcast.com. That's the address. Just send us an email with a link or whatever, and we will consider and probably talk about it on the show. So the first link up here is the RAM cloud. We're trying to go through these pretty quick because, you know, we only have so much time. Sam, you want a cloud, a RAM cloud with 1,000 servers and 64 terabytes of RAM?
Yeah, 64 terabytes for under $4 million, I think.
Under $4 million, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to need that, Ben. So if you could please make that startup successful and get me one of those, that'd be great.
One thing I liked about this article is it talks about the latencies, basically saying that it was measured in 5 to 10 microseconds versus 5 to 10 milliseconds. Now, micro is 10 times 10, it's anything times 10 to the negative 6, and milli is anything times 10 to the negative 3, which is a difference of 1,000 times. Are you guys familiar with the term order of magnitude? Anybody?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes? Oh, well, then that's old news. That's three orders of magnitude, though, difference, which is pretty legit. You know, your web server runs three, you know, orders of magnitude times faster. Yeah. Okay, that's great.
I mean, yeah, this thing can handle a huge amount of requests, too. So you have, I remember reading about one of these RAM cloud type things made 5 years ago, and it could only hold, I think, well, I don't mean to say only, but it could hold something like, it was something like $10 million, and I think, if my memory serves, it could hold 1 terabyte, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And this thing was, it was for some government thing that needed some huge amount of I.O., and yeah, they said it saved them some huge amount of money somehow, so.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Well, because they're the government, they can afford to keep it on 24/7, which is the only downside. They said that, of course, we're talking about a RAM-based, you know, cloud here. So if things go down, you need replication.
Yeah.
You guys out there in podcast land, not looking at this article, might not have realized, or might be wondering, where's the replication, guys? You know, how do they solve that issue? But they, I suppose, were distributing them. So you know,
yeah, just buy two. 8 million, not a problem. Just get two.
Buy two of everything. Well, that might be redundant over redundancy. Who knows? I mean, they said it would be built in a little bit, so.
All right,
next thing. This is an Engadget article about how you can take a video of someone's cell phone and basically retrieve the keys they were pressing. So basically these people had like a real camcorder, like a home video's camcorder, and they were kind of zoomed in on someone like across, I think it was like out the window. They were on the second floor and this person was down at the bus stop. And you know how on the iPhone when you press a letter it pops up and gets all big? They were basically measuring that effect. And even from a great distance they could see exactly what you were typing.
And what's cool is the software
90% accuracy, yeah.
does this for you. It's not as if in you're zooming up on the video and trying to decipher it yourself. The software is actually, you know, programmatically sorting out which keys are pushed, and then it's like, yes, this is their password. They just typed it into their checking account.
And so one of the things – did you see the video here, Sam?
I didn't click the video.
Okay, that's fine. One of the things that they use is they show a difference image between each frame. They show a difference.
Uh-huh.
They show like the you know RGB, and then they show the difference view of the same data. And you talked about that over our intensive graphics design session. You want to tell us about difference images and stuff like that?
Yeah, in visual effects, one of the things you have to do when you're putting up a clean plate so if you have, let's say you have, I can't even think of an example right now.
A cowboy on a rope, and he's getting shot, and so the rope pulls him backwards.
Yeah, so let's say you need to get rid of that rope for whatever reason. You need to have a clean plate of the background. And so a clean plate can be made any number of ways. You can have you can make it using a 3D program, then try and line things up. But the ultimate goal is that you have to have some sort of motion tracking involved because your cameras are moving, you know? Things aren't, you know, shots aren't locked off these days. Otherwise, your effects look really fake. You know, you have to have the camera moving. So you got to match things up, and sometimes, unfortunately, you got to do it frame by frame. So when you're lining up the clean plate that you've made over the real-life footage that you want to have comped out, one of the best ways to get it pixel perfect is to put your clean plate over the old footage and then use differencing. So basically what happens is it highlights all of the differences, really it accentuates them.
No. Basically what happens is it takes the integer value of image 1 and the integer value
of image
2.
Dude, I'm talking visually, for God's sakes.
I'm talking basically means the underlying features and technology. You don't say on a high level this is how it works. High level is graphically how it works. Basically it would be the mathematically how it works.
Okay.
And Ben so, just went 39 pins on you. But that's good. No, it's good to clarify, and I would say that you guys are both right.
Yeah, I suppose so.
All right, Sam, so graphically, how does it look? What does it do graphically?
Graphically, the entire image essentially turns black. You can look at it, you can zoom in extremely closely, and when the both of the... If you have something... You have to have something remarkable. It helps, like some like a sun flare or like an edge of something, and you want to pinpoint line up both of those items together, because otherwise it becomes sort of mismatched and blurry because your cameras have distortion. So it takes a fair amount of effort to line up that and eliminate it. So using something like difference can make or break a shot.
So
it
lets you see the changes a lot better. Like if you would just had normal RGB view, you could try to get it as close as you could. But then if you really wanted to make it all the way, you take it to difference, right?
Pretty much.
And so there's programs out there that do this, and it's mostly for which the use cases you kind of just gave, as in video editing?
Well, we used it in Real Money Slots.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, how'd you use it there? I'm curious.
Well,
we have basically a background view, and then we're trying to animate parts of the background, and then we have buttons floating on top of the background. And for a while, we were doing squares around the buttons, but then we started putting alpha channels in the buttons so you could actually like overlay them properly. Sam, you were using it for reattaching something, maybe, was it?
Well, yeah. Basically, to make it animated, between the frames, there was a subpixel difference, and so to get things to line up correctly between the frames, you had to use a difference channel in order to make sure. Because you couldn't see it until you start stepping through it, and then you see that there's
a
subpixel
difference.
And then
it's a pain in the butt to have three things open in Photoshop, and then alt-tab.
Yeah, and then remember, because when you're switching between them, like there's a subpixel difference to the right, which means you have to nudge that thing to the left.
That got me a couple times.
Yeah, my Liz Dexia would not like that at all.
Not at all. So since I didn't see the video and I don't want to play it right now because I might screw up my call burner or something weird, if I'm typing with two hands really fast, can this thing still handle that?
Dude, it's per frame. As long as the frames are fast enough to type to pick up each thing, you're good to go.
Gotcha. Okay.
Hardcore. And I believe because it must. I'm pretty sure it's post processing. It's not live processing. But right. When they run the post processing, it draws bounding boxes. So they have a view where you can see a computer overlaid bounding box as it comes up on each frame.
Oh.
So it's something to be aware of. If you're out in public on your mobile touchscreen device and you're
entering
happily
a password and you're chilling at the ATM, well, maybe you're on camera on the ATM.
Oh, how does this thing deal with uppercase letters? Can it detect? Does it detect the shift?
Well, the idea is that your view is pretty good, that you could see all the letters change. I mean, it's a way to automatically pull out a sentence. It's not a way to, like if you could see it on the film, then this will reconstruct it a lot quicker.
Gotcha.
And it's the moral of the story is, if you're typing something extremely sensitive in your phone, hold it close enough to your chest such that no one could have an external view.
And also, you know, kind of remember that just a person looking or a camera, you know, just remember that that feature that Apple added adds extra vulnerability, you know, in all cases.
Yeah. Which you can disable, I'm pretty sure, right? You can disable the magnified keys on keypress. I'm pretty sure you can.
Certainly with jailbreak. I don't know if I get it.
I think maybe even in the factory iOS. So that might be something we check out later. So that was interesting to learn about that and be aware of.
So another side channel that Mike Shaw sent in to us was this researchers can keylog your PC using your iPhone's accelerometer. So we had a question about accelerometers, and I might have mixed up some words on gyroscope and accelerometer in that previous tech question, but basically they are using the accelerometer component to measure the vibration of the table. And as you type, they can basically detect how far away the letters are from the phone, something like that, and are able to reconstruct with pretty good accuracy the things you're typing in.
Yeah, it's very clever, but extremely impractical at the same time.
I believe I didn't actually read this, but I heard it explained to me. Basically, what they did is they were able to map key presses, whether they were on the near side of the keyboard, on the upper left or the lower of the near side, and then upper or lower on the far side of the keyboard. So by splitting the keyboard into four segments relative to where the iPhone was, then they compiled a dictionary of all known words that they wanted to crack. They compiled it into the upper, lower, upper right, upper, lower left, or whatever thing, and then they compared what they read from the iPhone to this dictionary they had compiled themselves.
Another little pointer towards the fact that you should be using completely made-up words in your passwords that would never be found in any type of crackhead
dictionary. That's a good point that they had a dictionary on it. That's a very good point.
So that's all the better.
They said that with the iPhone 4 they could do it. iPhone 3 didn't have the resolution, and the way they were able to make the resolution was by using the iPhone 4 by adding the gyroscope. So here's where the gyroscope and the accelerometers are different. Mm. The accelerometer can measure the acceleration of the Earth, whereas I believe the gyroscope cannot, because that is a twisting rotational measure.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me that the sample rate on the accelerometer is too slow. So basically, it's not taking, it's not reading the analog physical properties of the real world quick enough into memory in order to be able, you lose resolution. You know, it might be like taking an MP3 and compiling it at 16 kbps or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of lose a lot of the quality, right? But they were able to use the gyroscopes to clean it up. And in my reading, what that means is they might actually have been taking, a gyroscope's going to be a whole separate chip with a whole separate sample rate. So they might have basically doubled the sample rate of information coming into the phone by adding that second sensor. I don't know how much the gyroscope would help with, actually rotations, but just the vibrations. Basically, they just have two separate measurements of the same waveform, and they're able to clean up the signal, a.k.a. they double the sample rate, so it sounds twice as good, something like that.
Nice. So if you ever are about to type in something very secure on your laptop and someone else's iPhone is sitting
just chilling
on
there,
be wary of what's going on.
So I've heard someone rehash this on another podcast, and they said that this is actually a very specific use case. Like, they had to have the keyboard of the phone on the left only, and they had to it had to be a wooden table, and it had to be very quiet but no vibrations from fans or other things like that.
Yeah.
So you could turn on a big dildo and vibrator and put it next to your – install it on the bottom of your keyboard.
If you just happen to have one on your desk, it's not like, go buy one. It's just if it's laying around.
Yeah, right, no judgment.
Right. Tape it to your keyboard, and you'll be good to go.
There's a giant black dildo, and I've got nothing against black dildos. Let me just preface it with that. Duct taped to the lid of your laptop, you will be safe from this side channel. Oh, man. That's one of my favorite little things about the Google. If you open up a incognito window in Chrome, it gives you the warning. Why am I not seeing it right now? Here we go. Google Incognito doesn't affect the behavior of other people, servers, or software. Be wary of websites that collect or share information about you, internet service providers or employers that track the pages you visit, malicious software that tracks your keystrokes in exchange for free smileys, surveillance by secret agents, and last but not least, people standing behind you. So as you're fantasizing about these ridiculous side channel attacks, which some are and some aren't, granted, you should be aware of the basics too if you're dealing with sensitive information, because if you're too deep into anything, that you can get lost in the details and not realize the bigger picture. So watch out. People stand behind you. They can see what you're doing.
And the final link sent to us by Mike Shaw is titled Researchers Hack Crypto on RFID Smart Cards Used for Keyless Entry and Transit Passage. Basically, they're talking about how they cracked a crypto on these cards, and I believe the way these RFID cards work is the if you think of the reader as the server, the server basically has to power up the card, so it gives it a sine wave and a magnetic on the magnetic frequency to power the card up, because the card can have coils or whatever, and then sends it a message, so it sends it like basically a random number, and the card has to take a cryptographic function, compute the random number, and return it in order for the server to make it work. In order for the server to verify a valid read. And so they said that they were able to crack this mechanism by using a side channel. They needed to have the card, I guess, in their possession, an RFID reader, and a radio probe. And using differential power analysis, they're able to collect the data from the radio frequency energy that leaks out of the card through side channels.
Oh, it's 112 bits.
Yeah, through the process, they were able to retrieve the entire 112-bit secret key, which uses triple DES.
That's pretty interesting. Is this the same or similar system to what some companies will give employees their cards to access buildings?
Yeah, proximity cards.
I believe
cards.
So. I believe it's the thicker ones, the thicker style RFID.
I wonder. Because obviously, you know, you'd be suspicious if you saw like a small lab team with instruments set up near a card reader. That would be the first clue that something's going on.
I don't know if I guess there was another side channel, which I didn't add into the show notes or whatever, but I saw this description of... basically, a guy took, speaking of smart cards that are the ones in Visa and stuff like that, you know how you can just touch and go with your Visa whatever card?
Yeah.
What he did is he purchased a gateway. So he basically signed up with the gateway and said, I want to process credit card transactions for my Quickie Mart. And then he put the software or whatever in his laptop and in his briefcase. And he was able to just hold his briefcase next to people's wallets and charge them money. Because he's going through the official channel, right? There's no hacking or anything involved.
See, that's the old school creativity that I love. So many people spend so much effort trying to do ridiculous things, but when you just go and charge people on the street random money, then it's the simplicity you gotta love.
It's like, oh, business is booming.
That's cool.
It says here that this attack they're talking about requires hours or days of lab time. So, you know.
But yeah, you gotta crack it. You have to crack that key.
Well, through side channels, yeah. So, I mean, this is also something, this technology, or something similar is what I want to release on GitHub. I basically have a need for this kind of transaction between an iOS app and the server, a PHP server. Basically, this key, and then you hash something, or you do triple DES, or you do whatever you want, and then you return the results, and you're able to see that it's signed and stuff like that. So one of the things I'll work on eventually is I'll put that up on GitHub and make it an open source thing, like a really simple, like 10 lines to send data between your iOS and your PHP server securely, you know? Mm. It'll be using a shared secret key. So, you know, a little bit different than SSL, a little bit easier to get going because you don't have to send keys back and forth. So it's pretty cool.
I like it.
So that would be the end of Mike Shaw's feedback.
Thank you, Mike. That's good stuff. And, you know, we randomly do end up talking about security-related stuff more often than not. And, Mike, if you ever happen to want to jump on and be like our security guy on the show...
We would love to interview you on the podcast.
Definitely. Or, and you could even come up with probably a better name than I just gave you. You can even pick your own nickname, in fact. So that might be fun. And we'd love to have you on if you're interested.
I have one more story here. Sam, did you put this in here?
The Dooku
one? No, I put that in. What's up? I contributed.
All right.
So it was when I saw this link, I was excited because every time I read anything about Stuxnet, I get all hot and bothered about how cool that whole exchange was and, you know, the fact that they were able to do physical damage targeted to a specific machine in a specific country, and that might be a simplification of what happened, but that's the basic, you know, level is super impressive to me. And
they were hopping offline. It was hopping on USB sticks, right?
Exactly.
So to offline network or off
traversing network, like any channel that was ever connected to, you know, any other thing. It was
More than I would say, I'm not connected, but like plugged into. I don't know what the right word is. Like
docked.
Like docked and then undocked. Anytime any docked with anything else in the past, it was able to. Like, yeah, that's a better example. Yeah, crazy. Yes.
So this one article I found is talking about the son of Stuxnet, and that title is a little bit leading compared to if you read the article. And if I remember correctly, the short version is they found some evidence in this bit of very creative virus code that indicates it was born quite a while before Stuxnet, or something along those lines. I don't want to read the article, actually, but according to the tidbit of information, this one researcher says that the authors of this virus, which is called Dooku, D-U-Q-U, or Delta Uniform Q? Was Q the one I couldn't remember?
What's Q? Dooku.
Q-U. Well, anyway, Q is a quarter.
What's Q?
Quartz? It's not quarter. I can't remember right now. God damn it. It must be Q. Uniform. Dooku is the name of the virus. They say if the information is correct, the authors of Dooku must have been working on this project for over 4 years. So it's hard to say that just because they found these dates inside, that's what actually is happening. But it's also interesting to hear anything related and hear about stuff related to Stuxnet or, you know, the conception of, because that's just still super impressive to me.
Quebec.
God damn it. It probably was Q. I'll bet it was.
So I've heard some, this was kind of a little bit of sensationalized. I've heard more recently that they don't think they were extremely connected as much as they were.
Mm.
But I will tell you, about Microsoft basically released something about the vulnerability, the zero day that Dooku was exploiting. You guys know zero day vulnerability is something that someone has found this, you know, software hack, but they haven't released it or used it. Basically, meaning that no one, you know, the world is unsuspecting. No one besides you has discovered this vulnerability. So if you use a virus, you know, virus detection engines might not know. The operating system is certainly going to get owned, right? I mean, that's why, you know, that's why it's so amazing, because it's a zero day.
Yeah, everybody's screwed.
So the Dooku uses a zero day in Windows, in the Windows kernel, actually, which is kind of fucked. it's in the TrueType font engine.
So as
it was explained to me, it's always the font.
God damn it. It's always the fonts.
So for those of you who don't know, there is a difference in operating systems between user land and then the kernel. That's what the Linux terms are, would be user land and then the kernel. I would not be the right person to explain it to you without looking it up. I was taught this difference in my college education, so I should be able to remember
classes.
That.
It's been a while. I can't.
But basically, it's like, you know, it's basically the program that's running that is the Windows kernel versus any other program that you're running. If you get an exploit in there, that means you can do anything you want, because you can basically breach that barrier. The question is, why is Microsoft rendering the fonts in the kernel? That's something that should be done in user land, because that's a graphics display thing. That's not like a memory management or anything else like that.
Yeah.
So basically, I heard that they did that. They did that for performance reasons.
Performance reasons.
Like back in the day, you know, the computers weren't fast enough to be able to handle that. Because when you put something in user space, there is a performance overhead.
Fonts were basically a big deal back in the day. You loaded too many fonts in, your computer was so done for.
That's probably why, because it's in the kernel.
It was finished.
That's actually probably exactly why. The creep just kills you, right?
Yeah. With my old computer, it's 4 megs of RAM. I remember I put in like 20 fonts. It just took like an hour to boot up. I was like, wow, that's a problem.
I'm so jealous of your old computer experiences. Like, seriously, I missed out. I guess I just didn't go deep enough, because I remember playing Oregon Trail, like, in fourth grade, I think it was, at recess, when the other kids were outside, like, making friends. I was in the computer lab, not talking to anyone. So, I guess because I had my gaming phase early on in life, not only was I socially stunted, but I wasn't worried about how it worked at that point in time. It wasn't until later that I went deeper and, you know, started to learn stuff. But that's why it's still impressive to me, Sam, when you talk about your old computer experiences and you go back. I'm like, I'm just a little bit jealous of all that. But back to...
Well, it was part of it was that I had a 486 and a 2400 baud modem, and never had the resources to upgrade it forever. So I was sort of stuck with that.
So how old were you
stuff.
When you had that? Do you remember?
Like 12.
That's awesome.
So it was pre-Windows 95. So, you know, I used Windows 3.1 forever. Yeah. It's a disaster. And
I guess in my defense, actually, 12. Maybe, no. I
Dude,
might
you're
have been
only like 2 years younger than me.
The girl up the street by then, so I was busy making pretend babies, if you will.
So, but there is a security fix for the Dooku exploit. For the Dooku zero-day that we were talking about, everybody's fucked. Microsoft has now unzero-dated it. And I just put this in the bottom of the document. It says Dooku fix, if you guys want to pop it up.
Nice.
There's a little icon, that little Microsoft Fix-It Man, and you just click the one that's under Enable. There's an Enable and Disable, which makes it a little bit confusing because the words aren't big enough. But
and
click
if
Enable,
you are
and then fixes this issue.
Security person, or you're interested in security stuff, or you seriously know everything there is to know, you probably already know this, but for people who aren't, I find it very interesting that zero-day exploits are actually traded like any other commodity out on the black markets that exist out there in the dark places of the internet, the bad neighborhoods, as Google likes to call them. So you can actually, if you are the type to find a zero-day, you could make a serious amount of money depending on how serious of zero day it is.
Yeah,
and
a kernel zero day.
That's
gold mine. That's
got to be worth at least a new Mercedes, I'd bet. Like, seriously.
Yeah, and the thing is that companies will give prizes for people who come forward with the exploits. And the prizes, like Google gave a 1337, you know, the spelling for elite. They gave, you know, $1337 for people to do this with Chrome, which is pretty cool, right? But if you can get a new Mercedes, you know, whatever you know, class
you
want.
You can go for $1,300 or closer to $100,000 for a kernel zero-day exploit.
And so, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, the reason that you have open source is because people fix it, you know, it's a little bit different, you know, everyone's contributing, but with Microsoft, you know, it might even be hard to submit security exploits. That's another thing, is that sometimes people don't listen to you. Like when Sony, the beginning of Sony's avalanche effect, was when they got hacked because their Apaches were way out of date, and security researchers had told them, hey guys, fix your Apache, right? We found a security vulnerability in your entire network, fix Apache. And then that was the first domino. After that, people were like, well, maybe does Sony patch this server? Did Sony patch this server? And they just fucking came down hard.
God, seriously. If no one else learns anything from that, it's do update your Apache.
Yeah, it's tragic. Someone's being paid a lot of money to update Apache and didn't do it.
It's just, yeah, seriously, the PR nightmare that ensued from all that. And, you know, I mean, damage control is one thing, but then the fact that, you know, you got to wonder if and when the information that was leaked, stolen, whatever you will, if that was exploited, and then, you know, what the repercussions are going to be for Sony, because obviously your credit card numbers out in the wild are never a good thing.
That's for sure. How long did it take? Do you know offhand how long it took Microsoft to patch this? I'm trying to see a date here, but...
I don't know, but apparently they discovered it right around the patch Tuesday. So that's another thing I was going to say, is that if you are in the position to sell or buy one of these, if you're in the position to buy one of the zero days, because you bought it, that means you're pretty calculating, right? What you want to do is going to have to net you more than it costs you to buy
the
zero day,
it's
right?
It's an investment.
And so if it's a banking thing, what they want to do is they'll wait till maybe one day before Patch Tuesday or 2 days before Patch Tuesday and release it, because Microsoft's going to release the patch, and then they're going to have an entire month where they are going to be working on the fix, and it won't come out for a month. So that means you might get 1 month of zero-day readiness on this bug. So that's why we're advising you to go ahead and close the gap on that by going to that Microsoft Fix-It. But I mean, if you're that cold and calculating, you wait till the cycle is right. You know, you wait till the tide is right, and then you go surfing with everybody's money, if you will.
Nice, I like it.
So go to that fix. It's in the show notes. Do we have a podcast to do, guys? Is that what we're doing right now?
Well, I was thinking about it, but then I was staring at my computer screen and I got distracted with the pretty
ADD
colors.
Plus one.
No, we're at two or three now, at least.
Yeah, plus one, dude. Wherever we were, add one.
Oh, so you're just adding on the stack now.
Plus.
Get it.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Do you want to tell us your Drupal story?
I like that. Yeah, ADD plus. That's what we'll use from now on. That's a good one.
God, that's so...
Yeah, tell... What's your Drupal experience? I'm curious about
How did I fucking get referred to this guy? I don't remember who referred me to him, but it was a bad connection. I don't know. It's
but
these
I
things
hate
where it's
them.
Like I'm looking for...
I don't
for...
know who told me. I hate them, though. Whoever's fault this was.
It's like one of those things where it's like I'm looking for a web developer and... Oh, do you know someone? Oh, I know someone who knows someone, and I got referred for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And his website was originally had been designed and designed kind of well, I think, from a graphics standpoint, but it was just might have been static HTML. Then someone came by and did a rehash. So basically it was like all hacked already at that point. You know how that kind of goes when someone doesn't know what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then someone came by and did a shitty attempt at doing templates. American Sam. So what they had done is they had each page load was actually three PHP files. It was a header, the body, and then the footer.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a mess. And that was how they did templates. They didn't have any separate, you know, the PHP was just laid right in the middle, and it was all bad.
Yeah.
So this guy was like, upgrade me to Drupal because I've heard about that. And I wish I had done my research and put him on fucking WordPress. No,
something
I went
else,
with
anything else.
Anything else besides Drupal. Because he wanted something super simple he could just go in and edit,
yeah.
Whereas exactly what WordPress is. Whereas Drupal is oriented at programmers, so they know how to do PHP modules and loads in and things like that, right? So I ended up modifying the templates wrong because I didn't know how to do it because I'd never done Drupal before. And his site had, like... The main template was totally uniform across all the pages unless you were on the home page where it loaded in this extra table because I was trying to preserve the original table layout, which is how it had been designed, by the way, with very little CSS,
mm-hmm.
except for the CSS that was inlined and then, you know, tacked on top of the other style. It was so bad.
Dude, that sounds like a catastrophe.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm just getting my feet wet in Drupal, and it's... At first glance, not intuitive, and it seems like certain parts are arbitrarily complex, but I'm hoping that there's a reason, and I'm hoping once I wrap my mind around it that it's going to be, oh, well, they do this because it's going to make this simpler, and that's what I have a feeling, but I'll have to report back on our next podcast and update and let everyone know what the land of Drupal 7 is like. And that's the other little unfortunate bit is... The newest and the best thing in software isn't always the easiest or most intuitive thing to work with because there's a lag with the documentation, you know, as everyone may or may not learn. And you know,
example programs and stuff like that and the general experience on the internet as well.
Exactly. You know, when the more usage something has, the more content's going to be out there. People saying, oh, this works.
Literally, it's little
work.
Posts, and they're always spread across the entire internet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you learn a language, and all the little forum posts that are, like, super useful are spread on every single different website.
It's like there's a rule somewhere that documentation can't be that easy to use or understand or learn from, that you have to go to actually the forums. That's where you learn it. It's kind of funny. So we'll see. I'll update everyone when we get back on here in 2 weeks exactly, because that's what we're doing from now on.
All right.
And
sounds good.
Keep you all posted on Drupal 7 awesomeness, hopefully.
Definitely. Real quick, I was dealing with a really, really irritating virus that wasn't yet added to any virus signatures with any of the programs I use, which is basically Avira, Malwarebytes, and Microsoft Security Essentials. So some basically zero-day type virus that was really irritating. And
how'd you even find it in the first place, then? I'm curious.
Well, here's the problem. Ben is BRB, and I sort of need him for this, but whatever.
God damn it, Ben.
God.
Well, go to continue with the
but
track.
But we can go with
tell
this.
Tell me
so,
about what you do now.
So the virus, what it was doing, it was very irritating. It was a browser helper object of sorts. but it was a little bit, it was more hardcore than that. It wasn't just the browser helper object, which, are you familiar with those?
As in plugins, or?
Yeah, they're sort of, they have like a history that goes back, but basically it integrates itself into the browser, and what it was doing, it was
for all browsers, or?
It tries to cling on to as many as it can. In this case, it's Firefox, Internet Explorer, and Chrome. But it was only doing it for Chrome and Firefox, not for IE for some reason.
Yeah, I know. That's kind of weird, right?
It was really weird. But for whatever reason, I was reading lately that Internet Explorer has a more hardcore security record than Firefox lately.
We got to give props when props are due. Microsoft, you're doing something right.
Yeah, I was surprised. There's something about like the statistics. I'm going to have to refine that. Let me add to show notes statistics. Yeah. I was really surprised to read it. I was like, seriously? Because, you know, Microsoft has never gotten a pass since IE6. So
where do these browser help projects come from?
Usually they reside in, I wish I had my notes with me right now, but they get loaded automatically into the browser. They're generally hidden. And what it was doing is it was inserting itself between Google searches. So if you search for Variable Gigahertz or Portport Podcast, hit enter, and then it would show the search results in Google. You would click the link, and then it would immediately redirect you to some like ad catastrophe of a website.
Some horseshit website.
So you could click links
to, like,
and then give them money.
Screw your life over.
Exactly. And so, of course, it was trying to, like, whatever it was, it would never get to you to your end site. It was like travel ads. It was all kinds of ad mess. And so,
I mean, this ties in with the thing that Google's going to do, is where they're going to start encrypting your searches, right?
Oh, that would be nice. That,
if you're logged into Google, they're going to encrypt your searches for this very reason and for other reasons as well.
I love it.
Clever. So I took it offline. I did after Malwarebytes, couldn't find anything. It just, like, nothing was finding anything. I was like, wow, I'm going to have to do this manually and figure out what's loaded. And so one of the cool things you can do is you can take a system offline or even when it's online and just sort services by the last write time in the registry, and you can find out what has been installed most recently. And usually you'll find a trace of that piece of malware in there. And then you can sort of backtrack through it and then get rid of it or rename it or whatever the hell you want. And so I was just wondering what, Ben, you know how you dealt with that virus in Linux, the hardcore one?
With the diff, yeah.
Yeah, that was intense. What do you do these days when you get viruses in your work systems that are running XP?
Well, if you did it the proper way, you would have a golden image where all the machines were off of a golden image, and you put things on the golden image would be things like WinRAR in Microsoft Word, or maybe you put Word on but you don't activate it with a key, right? So then they all have their own activation keys or like whatever, right? And then you would be able to diff against your golden image, and the longer they had been using it away from the image, the harder you would have to do it, right? But you'd probably be able to figure it out. But one thing I think that would be very useful that I don't know of a solution for would be to see if you were able to, let's say, list all the services, or list, like, give me a text report of all the services. Give me a text report of all the what's that program called? Hijack Me Not. Have you seen that, Sam?
I've only heard of Hijack This.
Is that different? Okay. That's the one. Hijack Me Not is a combination of Hijack This and BugMeNot.com.
Okay.
Which is a separate thing.
Someone should register that domain name right now.
No, it's there. It works. I can tell you about what it does. But if you had a Hijack This output, that tells you all the hooks into IE. It tells you file system hooks. I think it tells you right-click menu hooks. Like, you know, Tortoise SVN Merrick has all those right-click, all those hooks in there. All that kind of stuff. So if you had text reporting tools, Sam, on top of just the binary, you would get more vision into what was going on in those binaries.
All right.
That was something I was doing at my job. I'll tell you a little real quick, unless you want to finish up your question.
No, I don't think so. It was basically just a segue to get into that. So please break it down.
You didn't want to segue into anything else?
Not yet.
Okay. So...
Wait, just for clarification, because I don't actually know, and in case the listeners don't know, what is the source of these helper objects? Are they installed with other programs, or do they come from the internet, as in when you click on a bad link or site? What's the original penetration point for these things?
Well, a browser helper object can certainly get installed just the same way a virus would get installed. It's just a different form of a virus.
Like Java. Like a Java or Flash plugin, right?
Yeah, I think so. The whole purpose.
I was just curious.
Yeah, the purpose of them. Yeah, I think I'm inclined to say that Flash and Java are variations of a browser helper object. But there's a lot of them that you install yourself. You know, they're different than a toolbar. You know, toolbar is visible. You see a toolbar there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, God, I have the fucking Yahoo toolbar again.
So that has a that helper has a UI component, basically.
Okay. Yeah. So these are invisible. These helper objects are invisible to the end user.
Yeah, you have to look for it. And then there's all sorts of really clever ways that they're hidden from the view as well. So.
Well, the Dooku, backing up a little bit, the Dooku, I believe what those kind of viruses do is because they're infecting the kernel layer, stuff like that, they affect the way that the operating system reads the drive. So they insert themselves between the OS and the drive, and when the OS does a read on their folder, they remove those file names from the folder. So the OS literally does not know. So a normal virus scan cannot see onto the drive because it only sees what the OS sees.
That's awesome.
And then I believe the way that the virus gets around that itself is it probably just grabs an absolute address. Like it knows it has a separate way of recording the address of those files on disk, and it says, please force load these bits off the disk. Like it's able to, like, you know, use a pointer, like some sort of low-level pointer thing to figure it out.
Yeah, so in other words, like as low-level as a virus will get.
Well, that one's extremely low level, right? Because it's between the disk and the OS. So if they fuck it up, then the OS isn't going to run, and their virus has failed to steal the passwords or whatever, right? So they have to make sure they write that shit correctly.
Yeah. Impressive. So we were talking about...
Sam's browser objects. Oh, my work. I was going to tell you about my work a little bit.
Yeah.
So the reason I... So. Let's back up. So Sam was saying, you know, I've got these two computers and I want to take a diff, right, Sam, basically?
Right.
Somehow.
Do you use WinMerge to...
I do use WinMerge. So my response to him was use WinMerge, but if you had extra reporting, you know, because just basic WinMerge will tell you the difference in the binary files. Mm-hmm. But the binary files really do contain some sort of strings at some point, but it makes it a lot easier if you were able to run a report on that binary file and pull out all the strings in a fashion that could be saved to a text file and then run WinMerge on those two text files.
Right.
And the way that I did that at my work was basically something I was bragging about on Twitter if you were following me, but our boards have a very fixed memory map. They have basically 1 megabyte of addressable space, half of which is flash. Only half of that is quote-unquote hard drive space. The rest of it's RAM, right? So you have to be very careful about what goes into what part of your 512, you know, K of flash there. And we had previously had a very fixed map of what goes where the source code goes in one place, and then the images, if you had images, would go somewhere else. But many people don't load images. You know, at my work, the boards are very versatile, and so if you have a web server, you want images. But if you don't have a web server, then you're not really dealing with images. You're just dealing with, like, voltages and controls and motors and things like that. And the serial port, that's the only, you know, feedback you have. So because we had such a rigid map, it was causing issues where people would run out of memory. So we were doing some really complicated things where we were borrowing memory from this section if it wasn't being used and telling the compiler, okay, by the way, compile into that memory, and some pretty complicated things, right? And Sam, the only thing that I was able, I mean, my part of my goal was to basically upgrade the system without changing any binary output. So after I was done, I should get 100% the same diff. Right, Sam?
Gotcha.
So the file I was most concerned with was the final file. The way that our tools work at work is they compile into like 10 different stages to get from the source code to assembly to binary to blah, 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 to blah, 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 to something you can send over a serial port down to your board and have it run on the CPU that's half fourth, half C. Like, pretty crazy, right?
Yeah.
And so the only thing I was concerned with was that final file, because of that's the actual bits that you send over the serial. All the rest of the files are just reports, and they're binary files, but they're kind of useless, because if I get exactly the same output, that's the only thing that gets loaded onto people's, you know, customer software, whatever. So I was trying to make these changes and guarantee binary compatibility, but I was running into issues where maybe one byte would change, and I was able to verify that that single change was okay, but I would still like to know more about what's happening with that single byte or whatever. So what I did was I changed the tools to have extra reporting, Sam, to be able to see into files that normally I didn't need to see into.
Right.
So I said, dump all of the variables in this file, or dump all the memory of here, or tell me the addresses of all of everything you know about this binary file. And GCC can kind of, it's like a core dump, Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you're saying, give me everything that you know about this core dump.
Nice.
And with these extra reports, I was able to do win merge against my before and after, and really empower my coding at work to be able to see exactly what I was changing to get exactly the same output.
Nice.
You with me, Merrick?
I like it. I'm inclined to say, so what was changing the bytes, but I'm not sure it's going to be a simple answer.
Basically where we were putting the bytes, where we told that it was okay to put stuff. And so by doing that, you might change the jumps, the assembly jumps to where they were jumping and things like that, basically, when it's making a subroutine call.
It is impressive that you're squeaking that amount of software into that amount of space. That's
512K of RAM is pretty crazy.
No, I have bad utilities in my system tray that use three times that much.
RAM, exactly,
yeah,
right?
Seriously.
One thing I would mention to you, Merrick, is just starting as a new guy on a job, one thing that I use when I'm doing some web development is if I'm doing an upgrade, like replacing something, like unbinding my classes, for instance, right, or other things like that, what I might do is I might say, okay, my goal is X, okay? Like, your goal is to refactor your program and make it run better, right? But that's all you want to do is just refactor. You don't want to change anything on the outside. You just want to change the inside, right?
Yeah.
So what I'll do is I'll save the entire web page out. So maybe I'll crawl the web page, or I'll find some other way to save, you know, all 10 HTML outputs or whatever, right? And then I'll make my changes, and I'll diff the outputs of the same, you know, I'll have some way to output all of those things.
So you can compare to the original.
You compare the output HTML, because the way your PHP runs doesn't matter to the user. All that matters to their browser is what you print over the line.
The presentation.
Exactly, the presentation, the final stage. So by changing the intermediate stages, if you do it correctly, you can go ahead and guarantee that your tests come back, you know, with 0 bytes changed between your diffs.
Yeah, I like it.
So that's something to keep in mind, all of you people out there in podcast land, is all that matters is the output file. If you can get that to be binary compatible or binary exactly the same, then you're doing something right, hopefully. You're not fucking shit up.
That combined with unit testing, and man, you'd be good to go. You wouldn't have to worry about anything anymore. Good talk. I like it. So we put some good work in, and we're here doing the podcast again. Again, listeners, sorry we took a little break there, but we'll make it up to you, if not through handies, maybe some BJs. I don't know. I don't know if we'll have enough time. We got a nice little Saturday planned here, so.
Who knows?
Hard to say.
Do we know how long this podcast is?
No,
do we want to make it real long for those people out there in podcast land?
And to make up for it?
Well,
if we're babbling incoherent nonsense, does it still make up?
I show an hour 28 right now.
Good
so,
news.
You know.
That's cool.
Keep it going if you want.
So, yeah. Yes, listeners, we're back in it. And if there's something you'd like to hear more about or less about, please hit us up. packets@portforwardpodcast.com is the email address. We all receive it. And then Ben usually actually responds to people, which is good. Someone on the show is still putting effort in.
Real quick, I do want to hear about the ice water story, but if I could give a quick plug for my startup.
Great. That was not... Yeah, okay. Go.
Well, I do want to know the story. So I've been working on a startup.
Wait, you have a startup, Sam?
Well, yeah.
Are you calling a startup now?
Well, it is a startup.
Dude, congratulations. I didn't know that you were naming it that. I thought it was just this thing you were doing.
I'm not clear on the difference. Maybe you could tell me what the difference would be.
The difference is you're committing, and that you're going to have something that's legit. And you know, once you give it a name like a startup, it's like once you name a baby, I mean, that shit's for real, right?
I suppose so.
It's happening.
Well, you've used the product, so I figured, you know. All right.
I've heard from other people that with or without a name, babies will happen. So you got to be careful of that. We'll not go too deeply into that because we try to stay on technology-related topics here in the show. But be careful of the babies is all I'm going to say.
Well, thanks for that tip, Merrick.
Yeah. Tip.
So we need beta testers. The product is a solution for file transfers. And to that effect, I'm going to stick in that image that you gave me, Ben, why the world needs SendNow.
All right.
And but I'm going to need a lot more beta testers. I don't know how many we have in the queue right now, but it's certainly not enough. So if you are an...
Is it a first-in, first-out queue?
yeah, I guess suppose it is.
So hurry up and register, guys. You want to be first.
So I'll just say that by being first, you may or may not get some extra perks down the road. Maybe some more storage. Maybe...
You get to be an early adopter, and yeah. You get to be cool in the hipster sense, as in you were doing it before everybody else was.
Exactly. So you should consider registering. It solves the file transfer problem that we have, and that's all I'm really going to say for now. And so if you're an early adopter, you should definitely register. The product is called SendNow, SendNao.com. That's pretty much it. Sign up. Need beta testers.
Great. So, Merrick, you missed out on this, but Sam and I went to, what was it, a Twilio hackathon? It was a real Twilio hackathon,
yeah.
Right? Was it a hackathon?
Yeah, that's what they called it.
No, oh. It was like a hangout.
I thought it was more of a hangout, but...
Yeah. Yeah, it was more of a hangout. So there's like a place kind of like Nextspace. Actually, they're all over the city, San Francisco, city of San Francisco, Merrick. Have you noticed this, dude?
I've heard about them, and it's funny because when I went to Nextspace, I thought it was like a new thing, but it turns out they're everywhere.
I thought it was so amazing, but they're everywhere.
Co-working spaces aren't new. We at Portford Podcast right. Just found that out. So sometimes we're a little slower on the less technical aspects of life. So
oh,
sorry
man.
About that.
So... should I tell the story, Sam? So you want to set it up, or they said we need a volunteer? And
yeah, like... I'll set it up. So Ben showed up a little bit late, and they had a programming challenge of sorts. And Ben was, you know, as he usually is, determined to get in the action as fast as possible. And so it seemed pretty simple. What did they want you to do? A FizzBuzz challenge. And Ben
so
was like, dude, I know all about that.
So if you guys don't know what FizzBuzz is, it's an interview question. And basically, it's pretty simple. I can explain it, but the basically they said, you know, you guys all know this interview question. It's a little simple program you have to write. Go ahead and then what did they say, Sam?
Well, I'm not really clear on what it is that you were programming. What stuck out to me was that you were all stoked to do it, and they grabbed this bucket.
of ice and put it in front of me
yeah,
and I was like they're like take off your watch. I was like okay.
This guy like, just drops the keyboard into the bucket of ice and he's like go.
And so it was a PC keyboard plugged into a Mac Air Mac top, you know, Mac whatever Air. And so the first problem is of course that you're using a PC keyboard on a Mac, which is a pain in the ass because all the keys are wrong. Alt is control, is up, is left. All the shit's backwards.
I was going to say the first problem being that it's in a bucket of ice.
Yeah,
that's
wait.
The second. Well, because I knew
to
that
clarify,
before
this is
he
in like
it in.
A clear tub of ice, and you have to reach into the ice to type then, right?
Yes, to type.
Yeah,
reach in the ice to type. And
so
the goal was
wow.
There was two of these bins with two programmers, and the goal was to write FizzBuzz before the other guy.
And what's FizzBuzz?
FizzBuzz can be basically simply explained as a loop that goes from 1 to 100. If the number is divisible by 3, you print fizz. If the number is divisible by 5, you print buzz, and then you print I as you go through the loop, 1 to 100.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then if it's divisible by both, you print both, which means it's really simple to write. There's no ifs or else or anything else like that. It's real simple. And so... I actually ended up losing this competition, which is pretty unfortunate. I tried my best. I was there. I started in Bash, and the keyboard kept giving me enters randomly. There would be enter, enter, enter. Basically, the challenge was you could only use the things that were on the laptop. And I've never really programmed C on a Mac before, so
or
I didn't go straight
ice,
for C.
Or in ICE, right? You never programmed
in ICE. Or in ICE.
Yeah.
But... I chose Bash, which was the wrong move. I should have gone for C.
Yeah.
My competitor went for Python, and the most interesting thing about trying to get this challenge done was the random interrupts that the ice water would interject into my valid keys. These keyboards were not
waterproof
by any means.
That thing was glitching out bad. He was getting like 100 back ticks.
I was getting back ticks all over the place. Before the back ticks, it started with a couple random keys and double keys, and you'd have to press enter a couple times. It moved on to home row, if you guys are familiar with home row.
Yeah.
It's front row, dude.
My home row is A-R-S-T-N-E-I-O.
Oh, yeah.
What do you know about that?
A little QWERTY. Front row is a thing on the Mac that basically takes you to a black full screen. It kind of fades into black, and then there's like three or four items. Something that you would be able to select with a remote, which is actually, I have a remote for my laptop, and you can pull it up and go through and go to your pictures and whatever, iTunes and stuff. But apparently there's a key command from the keyboard that brings this up, and I saw it open one time. It kept opening. I guess there was another thing. You know, what's it called? Exposé? Not exposé, where
spaces?
All the windows disappear, spaces?
Maybe, I don't know.
It went in and out of spaces, and on the way, it was like, you know, in and out, but then on the way in and out, it went in and out about 10 or 15 times. So as the spaces were getting bigger, they were like jittering as they went bigger, in like a little sine wave, if you imagine,
damn,
towards the progress of being all the way open. It was pretty trippy.
So, I mean, the guy you were going against, obviously he was having these issues too, right?
He had reboot issues where it kept sending the key commands to restart the Mac.
God damn.
So we all had our own fair share of issues.
So how deep was the ice? This is like blowing my mind.
If you were to put your foot about up to your ankle, so I guess kind of up past your wrist.
4 inches or so?
Yeah, 4 inches or so.
Wow.
But the keyboard wouldn't fit in the bin all the way, so it was either out one side or out the other side. The bins were just narrow enough.
Oh,
the keyboard
so it wasn't fully submerged. Huh.
Right, but yeah, it was fun.
It was definitely cold enough. Oh, whenever you reached over to the Mac to move the mouse, his hand was too cold, so it wouldn't.
I couldn't figure out how to Alt-Tab for the life of me, which was driving me insane because I wanted to have two windows open.
Mm-hmm.
And this plays back into the fact that the keyboards are all different, because I really pride myself in being able to whiz through an operating system without using a mouse. Like, for instance, if I got grounded, I couldn't use the mouse or something like that, right? So I don't know how to do that on the Mac very well, and not with a PC keyboard to boot.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take my hands out of the ice water to move the mouse to click the other window, and my fingers were so cold that the heat touchpad wouldn't work. I had to use the side of my hand, which was also pretty damn cold. Like, I wanted to use my nose up in there to, like, move the mouse around.
That's crazy. That's totally crazy. That's cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That's nuts. Yeah, that motivates me to remap one or the other just so it's the same and, like, I can, you know, not have to ever deal with it. Obviously, if there was a keyboard and a bucket of ice, they wouldn't have my mapping, so I guess it's relevant, but...
You could tell them, listen, if it better, you know, I need to step out or it needs to be Colmac, and they'll let you choose it,
let me get Colmac and these keys to here, and I'll do
at
this.
At the very least, that would be an honorable discharge.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a Colmac excuse. Of all the excuses, that would be a better
one.
You
could tag team up someone else.
Seriously, that's funny. That's cool. I like it. Well, props on that. I totally didn't hear that story till now. That's cool.
I was waiting to tell you on the podcast because I knew you would totally enjoy that shit.
I have
some photos. Cool. Perhaps we could include one or two.
Yeah, we might as well post one up. That's funny. So good job, guys. I'm glad we're all back here doing it again, and I look forward to next week after next, and when we record the next one and push it out.
Do you think
out.
It's going to happen? Is that for sure?
We're not doing weekly. We're doing
bi-weekly?
Yes, bi-monthly every 2 weeks.
Oh, bi-monthly?
Yeah. It's going down.
All right.
Stay tuned, listeners. Stay tuned.
Do we have other topics that we'd like to cover before we wrap this up? Any last thoughts about your security conference? Any last thoughts about your job, maybe, Merrick? Are you excited for the future?
I am. Even though I have less spare time to, well, I'll let you guys fill in the blank with your imagination. I am, because networking is important, and not that this is a huge company or, you know, that they're connected to everyone in the world, but the connections I make and the things I learn here are going to be valuable almost regardless of, you know, my startup status or what I want to do next, because it's just a resource at that point. So I'm glad I'm doing it. It had to happen sometime. I was in school long enough where people were like, what are you going to school for again? I'm like, oh, shit. I gotta get a job, apparently. Had to happen sometime. I wanted to be a Toys R Us kid, but shit.
Definitely, think about the fact that you want to train up all your skills, because you have a lot of, like, on-the-ground skills. Like,
fully.
You know, being able... And one of the things that'll come to you, which it's a stage I'm at right now, is the software architect stage, where you can look at a problem and you can see I can use this component and connect it to this component, and I can architect a solution where there was no solution before. And you just need to think about a little way to glue on each piece to the next piece, right? And that's kind of like taking the Twilio API, right? It's like, oh, I want to use Twilio API, and I want to connect it to this, and I want to make, you know, my site or whatever like that, right?
Yeah.
That's something that I think, Sam, you're coming up to speed a little bit on architecting stuff, right? We talked about that a little bit on chat, right, Sam?
Yeah.
Like drawing circles?
Yeah, it was really funny. You're just like, look, this is what I do all day. I draw circles.
I connect this thing to this thing.
No, the higher level view is important. If you're constantly at the micro and you're like, well, how can I turn this into this, and what do I need to do to make this thing talk to this thing, then sometimes you lose sight of the bigger picture. So it is important to either have that on a whiteboard or it's stored in a safe place in your mind such that you can see the bigger picture and know, you know, this is what we're trying to make happen, and, you know, are my assumptions correct, or do I need to try this, or what can we do to get there? So I definitely understand that, and I definitely look forward to, like, you know, this stuff becoming second nature, whereas right now I kind of have to read about it and, you know, learn about it, etc.
And also, those of you out there in podcast land, if you do things like this where you connect software together, think about adding the word architect to your resume. Just put it in. Just say architected this or did that, you know, retrofitted this to work with this system, whatever you want. You know, it really shows that you have oversight and vision into, like, over what you were doing. Kind of like what Neil was doing, our good friend Neil on the podcast. He said he had sort of upgraded his work to all these VMs, right? There was, like, had a couple of servers before, and he virtualized everything. He was architecting their new IT infrastructure, right? You know, he was kind of planning it out and making, you know, it'll work like this, this will connect to this, whatever. It's a very powerful skill to have.
Definitely. And obviously, it's that type of effort and that type of initiative that will distinguish you from your peers, in such that some people just go to work and trade their time for money and they'll just whatever. But if you go and you want to excel and you want to take it to the next level, doing things like that is obviously the way to go.
Sam, do you want to talk a little bit about those circles you were drawing? Is that relevant to our discussion right now?
Kind of, but before I mention circles, you remember how I asked you the other day about the way you deal with a hash database?
Yeah,
so
right.
So what I was looking for was a quick way to be able to hash a CD. Like, I really wanted to be able to just right-click on this, you know, the CD drive and just say, please give me a goddamn hash of this disk so I could just stick it into Excel or something.
And why did you need that?
Well, because I keep getting handed disks in work, and, you know, basically what the government does is, if any of you are unfortunate enough to get charged with a really horrible crime of some sort,
well, it shit happens. I mean, I'm not going to say I won't ever be charged, but go on.
Yeah, so, you know, it might happen. And as your case progresses, a whole bunch of documents and things will get passed between the government and the defense, and the process of the government or the defense giving stuff to one another is called discovery. So we get handed discovery, and the government will from time to time fuck with you and send you 10 disks that you already have labeled something slightly different when they know damn well they already gave it to you. And so this tends to trip up people in the legal profession, because they're not good with computers. They wouldn't think to maybe, why don't we just hash these disks and see if they match the other ones without having to open them up and manually dig through 100 PDFs that are now on the disk to see if they match or they're called something else. So I decided, why don't I just run them through hash, and then I could quickly see if they're the same. And so I did that a couple of times and isolated events, and I could just say, yeah, they're exactly the same pretty quickly, because the hash on the whole disk, you know, it's only like 100 megabytes or 200 megabytes, but there's a lot of files. I mean, I'm talking about like 300 WAV files of jail recordings or something with really messed up file names, because they're auto-generated by the prison. So to go through it manually is sort of a big chore, to like see if they're the same. So I got to look at the file.
And that
file
would be different per prison, probably. Everything's just out of control, right?
So, right, but even if I give you two disks, I'm like, hey, and I call them something else. Like, they're called jail calls.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's just adding to the problem. You know, you call them something else. What if you – do they add files on and make them different, or is it just
generally
per disk?
Like, they're not that high tech. They'll just like make like a copy of a stack of 20 disks, and then maybe like 19 of them be the same, then they'll give one disk that's different. So it's like, for God's sakes. That's how they use your tax money sometimes.
So I would add on that if you – the solution that we're about to talk about, it would be cool if you had a file list and a hash of those files either added on with the ISO somehow, stored as the same name as the ISO, or as on the disk or somehow, or in your little system that you're talking about.
Right. So I just made a quick system. I didn't have enough time to go through it. I had to get the disks over to the investigator, so hashed the disk, made an Excel sheet, put the title of it, stuck the hash in another category. And what I'm using a program called WinHex, and it's for free, but it's limited in the free version. So it, you know, if you want the full version, you pay for it. It's really good software, so it's actually worth paying for. But it's mostly a forensics tool. But it has one of the best hashing tools for forensics that I've come across. It lets you open a drive or open a disk to let you hash the entire disk rather than just hashing the individual files, which can also be useful, but there's a lot of tools that do that already. So this one will let you hash the whole disk. So I was using WinHex, and it's super quick.
And so how does it work? You right-click on the file or the whole disk?
No, unfortunately, you have to open up WinHex, and then you go under Tools or something, and then click Open Disk, choose the disk drive, then go under the same menu again, and then choose calculate hash. Then I was just did MD5.
That strikes me as the perfect solution for auto hotkey.
Seriously.
Where you double click, you know, you put the CD and you double click an icon on your desktop, mm-hmm. it just opens it up and then puts it in your clipboard.
That's right. And this is also the thing that really curiously crashed my computer. Remember that video that I sent you, Ben?
Right, right.
I still can't figure what that was about. That's only one disk was causing it to crash, calculating that hash.
So Sam basically is running this things through, was it WinHex, and then a certain CD would just lock his entire computer. Was it blue screen, or was it just straight to disk, straight to
that was
reboot?
It was straight to whatever. It just like it, I think it did something to the video card or something. I mean, it was
right. So
scrambled.
The video card lost sync, so you got a whole bunch of something overwrote the video card or whatever. It looks all fucked up in the video card memory, and then it just hard rebooted.
Yeah.
So that
it just stuck there. I mean, it never rebooted.
Oh, it just stuck there.
It just stayed.
Okay.
Forever.
So that problem came from WinHex, though, right?
No, that's definitely a kernel/driver problem.
Really?
WinHex is running in user space and can't really crash the machine like that.
Hmm.
Something that he was doing was messing with the kernel, and most likely it was the CD-ROM driver. So some interaction between the CD-ROM driver and then the kernel in kernel space caused a hard freeze like that. I believe it's probably an unhandled error with the CRC on the disk, Sam. You know how disks have that forward error correction stuff?
Yeah.
That lets, you know, if there's a tiny scratch, it'll be able to error correct around it, and it still know the bits perfectly. Right, Sam?
Right.
That system, when it fails, can do funny things to, like, if you absolutely say, give me the next megabyte of information, and it's locked, waiting, you know, on the air, trying to figure it out or whatever, or gives you an error code, then you might get in a poor state somehow randomly, you know.
Right, and in the case of a hash, it absolutely needs that data.
Right, it can't just say, oh, let's keep playing the music, and, oh, let's skip over the music. That's why music CDs really don't get affected by scratches as much as data CDs.
Yeah,
and if you think, oh, I have scratch CDs in my house and they skip all the time, well, imagine what they would be doing if there was data on there. So
yeah, don't worry about it. You don't need to render that file. It's like totally cool. Skip half of that data.
Cool. Just,
So I thought that video was interesting. It was just that one disk. So
What was the right click thing you sent me? Sorry.
Before. Oh, the right click thing. Hash tab. You said you already use it.
Just tell us about it. Come on. I'm not asking you because I don't know.
I'm sorry,
I want you
dude,
to tell the people in podcast Christ. Land, but thanks for revealing the fourth wall on this podcast.
Wait, I don't get the fourth wall. Tell me about the fourth wall.
I think it's either third or fourth wall.
No, dude,
it's
totally
like
the fourth wall.
It's a stage. It's a stage reference where, you know, people are on the stage, and on the stage has three walls, and then the fourth wall is between the actors and the audience, right?
Mm.
And so if you're breaking that barrier, that means that either you're interacting with the audience, or you throw, you know, something in the audience and people catch it, or use, you know, something like that as a fourth wall.
Okay.
Or in a movie, if you stare at the camera lens and start talking to
the
camera.
If you look at the lens, or movies like Airplane.
Yeah.
If you've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody?
I've heard it's funny, and I'm totally
like
trying to think
80s.
Of another movie where that happens when they look at the camera after one of those moments, and it actually is kind of funny, but obviously it doesn't happen too often.
It's movies that don't take themselves seriously, basically, is the fourth wall. Yeah.
Definitely. So, hash tab. I thought it was a really good implementation of hashing. It migrates really seamlessly into Windows. You can just right-click on a file and choose properties as you normally do. Then it creates an extra little segment in there which automatically computes the hash of your choice. And then you can also drag in a second file into a compare little section there underneath and then see if the hashes match. Super convenient, super quick. You should download it. Hashtab.
So actually, I have not used Hashtab, Sam. I was using Git for Windows that gave me exactly the same functionality, but it was missing one of the hashes. It looked different. I don't think it had the drag and drop thing, but everything else is the same.
That thing was super convenient.
I've been actually using something called the File Tweak Module by Fibooty, and it does not have drag and drop either, but I do like the drag and drop idea. In fact, I even remember once when I was like, I wish this had that, and now I know. So I'm going to have to get that now, I think. That's cool.
Oh, that's definitely cool.
Are you guys using Git or are you using SVN at your shop?
We're Git. I'm learning the Git.
You're on Git huh?
Now, yeah.
Do you have a GitHub account or are you guys using your own Git?
Repositoryhosting.com they're using, and I guess it's a good deal and awesome because they like it. And I was doing some of the basic commands today and I'm getting the hang of it. Granted, I had a halfway decent understanding of Subversion, so the fundamental difference is with each commit you have the whole project, so to speak, instead of just the difference between what you changed. So other than that, and the syntactic difference, Tortoise is a little different too.
Tortoise Git. It's a lot less featured.
Yeah, I actually hadn't played with it yet. I just noticed when I was clicking around, it looked different.
I actually would like to upgrade it to the way that Git to Tortoise SVN, because it looked like they forked some things, but other things they didn't fork. Huh. For instance, if you are you've made some changes to some files and you're going to commit them, in SVN, whatever you type into that box, if you Alt+F4, you click cancel or whatever, mm-hmm. it'll save that commit message. A lot of times I'll spend time authoring my commits in that box, mm-hmm. and then if I lose power or I accidentally close it or whatever, Windows decides to reboot, it's still there, right? Tortoise Git does not have that, and that burned me once. I was like, now I have to type out those two sentences again. Right?
Yeah.
But it seems like a really simple thing that I could just port over, and that's something I might look into as an open source. There's so many open source things I'd love to do. Like, if I had the time, I would contribute. There's so many things I want to just like put on GitHub.
You do
have
to be selective about anything you do, whether it's open source or for profit. You have to, spend the time where it's going to mean the most. So.
And Tortoise Git, the thing about Tortoise Git is that the reason that SVN is so popular was because of the Tortoise module. I mean, that allowed Windows users to have a very easy access to the source control.
I liked it.
And not only source control, but open source control. Like, if you think about the Microsoft source safes of the world and all the other ones that are, like, closed source, sold by a person, usually they're pretty crappy, first off. And second off, they lock your code away in a manner that is hard to get into Subversion or something else where it's freely accessible and convertible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a vendor lock thing. By promoting things like Tortoise Git, you are encouraging people in the world to have a better source code experience, just kind of like on the more altruistic, you're helping people get into Git, basically.
Yeah, it's obviously nice to give back to. Like, there's so often you'll go online and you'll be like, oh, I need something to do this, and you'll find an awesome open source tool that's like magical almost. You're like, I can't believe someone put time into this, and then you think about it, you're like, wow, I should give back because of how useful that just was. So it's nice in the software karma sense. So I fully support it in the sense that I haven't contributed yet, but I want to one day.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've actually gone on any specific project and helped out, but mm-hmm. I've always tried to help people on forums. Yeah. And actually, speaking of, I'm a big user on somethingwebsite.com.
Oh, me like too. I'm on that
Stack
one
Overflow. Stack Overflow super user. And
that whole network is actually pretty good.
It's called like Stack Exchange. So if you guys are looking for code.
It's a good source of information for sure.
Basically, if you want to ask questions and stuff like that, those are some pretty cool websites. Specifically Stack Overflow, I think. And then that's for programming. And then super user is for Linux server stuff. I actually got a warning from one of the moderators telling me I was promoting the podcast too much, because what I'll do is I'll go and I'll answer people's questions, and then I'll say, oh, check out my podcast.
That's funny.
Like, right? I mean, I'm helping them,
that's
but
lame.
I'm also
they,
putting...
They warned you, even though you're giving good answers with the promotion. That's dumb.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
I guess they have to be on top of it because they're like a major, you know, network, though, whatever.
Yep. Maybe if I link to maybe I'll make a podcast about the question and then link them to it, and then it'll be relevant. Check out this link and then not mention the podcast.
A warning's a warning, too. I don't know if it was that big a deal, so...
What if I make a post, put code posting up on portforwardpodcast.com and then link them there?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the rules are, but it's too bad that, granted, you know, you were still helping out that they were worried about it.
Yeah.
But I kind of understand it, you know, without context, it's like, well, whatever. So it's fine.
Exactly.
Nice. Strong work. Are we knocking on 2 hours now or what? Have we made it up
to
we're
knocking on 2 hours.
Our forlorn users without us, our listeners. Again, we're going to try to not be like that. We're going to try to stay with you here and keep you warm and fuzzy all the time.
All right. So upcoming plans for the next week, guys? Or the next, let's say the next 2 weeks, upcoming plans for startups. Startup business. Go, Sam.
Multiplayer mode in the...
Okay. Nice.
Percent Now is going to be completed. Uh-huh. Probably within... about a month, actually. So
nice.
But
nice.
The bare bones minimum viable product will be ready very soon. So that's why I need more beta testers. Got to get iterating on you guys, guinea pigs. You know how it goes. But you will be handsomely rewarded, yourself included, Merrick, Benjamin.
Nice.
Yeah. So it'll be good.
That's
should be
cool.
All right.
I like it,
Merrick.
I'm going to have to go to this thing called work and do that a little bit, but what I am looking forward
to... No, give me something in the next 2 weeks. You can spend at least a day. Come on, something started.
Dude, I seriously have no freaking time.
No time. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, Ben really doesn't want to hear it. Also,
that's
what
I'm surprised
my
how much
patent.
You do. I'm like not sure if you just sleep less or jerk off less or what, but I only have so many 3 hours in the day.
For God's sakes.
Hello, Sam.
Yeah, let me think about that. Hold on. What are you going to do? I'll think about my answer. What are you going to do?
Okay, I'm planning to be very close to releasing RMS. I'm going to work on my... I mentioned it. We were talking about the triple DES exploit for those cards through the side channels, through those reader cards. I'm going to work on my thing that's similar to that. I'm going to align the images on my slot machine wheels, try to get the user experience tied up, and maybe deploy to some people's... Maybe try and get a build that I can deploy. You know, like say this is a final build, right? And see how people respond to it. If I can get like a build that people can actually use, like a minimal viable product, by 2 weeks I'll be happy, because then I'll polish it some more and then I'll release.
Nice. I like it.
Nice. RMS is pretty damn polished.
That's what you say, Sam. I'm not polishing it in the terms of, oh, let me refactor my class structure, Eric. Mm-hmm. I'm doing things like, oh, if the user clicks this, does the app crash? Like, that's the kind of level I'm at, Sam. Nice. Removing all the crashes.
Does it crash a lot at this point?
It doesn't... Well, see, I knew that you were going to ask me that question. No, it doesn't crash a lot. But that's the order of magnitude of problems I'm fixing is on the same order as a crash. Like, maybe they'll get, you know... I can't even describe it, but it needs to be fixed.
Okay.
I like it. Strong work. Keep it up.
I will help you make the sound effects as well, because you've got to have the sound effects.
We got to have the sound effects. I hit a wall on that. I sat down one night and tried to do some sound effects, and I was not feeling the slot Vegas feel.
Okay. Well, I'll definitely give you some.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's unfortunate. When you want something to look and feel and work and sound well, it does take a lot of fucking effort.
That's for damn sure.
So I commend you in your pursuits of software excellence.
Oh, thank you, Merrick. Yes. What are you doing for the next 2 weeks? One day, give me one day.
I'm going to learn Drupal 7. I'm fucking sorry, man.
Okay. All right. That's your startup. Okay.
If I'd been with this company for 6 months, I'd probably have a little more free time. But I'm like, seriously, just like, oh, what's this? And I touch it. Oh, that's Drupal. That feels weird. And like, I have to go in and just go nuts on it. Like, I seriously, it's not intuitive. So I'm going to have to get into some fucking documentation and some manuals and just read myself into the next level. So that's what I'm doing.
Okay.
Sick, dude. Nice. Well, that sounds like some good plans, guys.
And then,
guys,
you know, and down the road when someone's like, oh, Drupal, I'll be like, yeah, I can actually tell you how that works, or, yeah, you should probably use something else. But, no, actually, I'm sure it seems complex at this stage just because I'm new to it, and because once I understand it, I'm sure it's powerful. So I'm looking forward to wrapping my head around it.
So those of you out there in podcast land, you should think about the next 2 weeks from when you hear this. What will you do that will promote your personal brand, your personal startup, you know, the thing that you're doing on the side to make those millions? So you got to think about that.
Definitely.
You know, my voice coming into your ears right now, you sitting in the car driving, you know, whatever. Think of those brain thoughts as to what you can do to take that edge on your competitors to become that next top programmer.
Definitely.
Does it involve an ice water bath? I don't know.
That's cool. We should do some more of those challenges. That sounds
dude,
fun.
We should set up our own challenges. It's like seriously. In the Facebook movie where they have the drinking challenge where you have to tack into something or
social
solve
network.
Something.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought of when you were telling me about it. I'm like, it's like that, but your hands are colder and you're not drinking, so actually that's not as fun.
could be beer or margarita ice water, dude.
The
margarita bath.
The crazy part is that the water shorting the keys out, that's still blowing my mind.
Right,
like, if
right.
you had a waterproof keyboard, how much cooler
would it
have been? Because then it's just dealing with, like, numbness, I think.
Right, so margarita bath plus waterproof keyboard.
You can either drink your way to freedom or you can hack your way to freedom. Either way. I'm personally going to take the drinking route. Just going to put that out there. Feeling like you can send it right back.
Oh, man.
Just
ridiculous.
Saying.
Sweet. So you guys think about that. Please tweet me, you know, port FWD podcast or variable GHZ for Sam or fast Charlie 4 for Merrick. That's fast C4.
Nice.
Go to our website, portforwardpodcast.com. Also, I don't know if you guys know this, but we have an RSS feed. It's that thing you put into iTunes to get the MP3s downloaded. Definitely should check it out because RSS feed is big. It's a big thing. You should get, you know,
it
some kind of podcasting
you
thing.
Keep your stuff. It helps you keep up to date with the stuff you like.
You know, what I like about having an RSS reader is I have 3 or 4 shows, or maybe actually like 6 shows, but 3 or 4 I listen to regularly, and it just uploads them. You know, when I'm sleeping, it'll download, the new MP3s, and I'll go in my car, and I'll know that there's going to be at least one thing new for me to listen to that day. You know, it's amazing.
God,
it's like
you,
I learned
you know,
about, you know.
You know what it's about time that I fucking love is the wireless sync between iOS 5 and iTunes now. It's about goddamn time, and that
it's
makes
about
my
goddamn
life
time.
That much better.
Yep.
So, Steve Jobs, I know you're dead, but thanks. Thanks for that.
Thank you very much, Steve Jobs, for
definitely.
iTunes. I agree.
And also, congratulations on the win by killing Flash. So, high five on that, too.
From the grave.
Strong work, killed Flash from the grave.
Like,
you gotta give credit where it's due.
I guess that happened, right? So Steve Jobs died since we last podcasted.
Yeah.
We obviously our best thoughts go out to him. Kind of a weird time to talk about Steve Jobs at the end of the podcast, but I guess we're wrapping up things. We're wrapping up our introspective of his life. You know, he brought us a lot of things. You know, I think that another person that passed away more recently is Rishi. I think his name is Dennis Rishi, something like that.
Dennis Ritchie?
Ritchie, yeah.
Yeah. He was legendary too, for sure.
He was a C Unix guy, and personally, I think that he had more influence on the computers we use today than Steve Jobs did, because your router, phone, and car all run Linux. So,
granted,
and robots
it's just you
on
know,
the moon.
It's just one was able to monetize, and you know, had the vision more so than. Not even just vision, but one was able to commercialize more than the other.
Yeah, you know, I've also seen it described to me as that, you know, Ritchie spent his entire life at Bell Labs. He didn't leave. He didn't try and, quote-unquote, monetize. And that allowed him to get a lot more research and innovation done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the tendrils of the things he affected penetrates our lives a lot more deeply.
So they're both legendary in their own respects, and, you know, definitely.
Our respects go out to both of them. It kind of makes you sad to think about the not the giants, but sort of the architects, the original architects kind of passing away, right? So,
well, hopefully there's a whole new generation ready to...
That's what we're trying to inspire you guys to be. Those people where this audio is penetrating your ear brain drums right here.
Make sure your ear grapes are listening to the sound chunks flowing into them according to what Ben's saying.
Exactly. So, portforwardpodcast.com, post something. Packets at portforwardpodcast.com is our email. Send us a link, you know, what have you. I think that we will sign off now, but thank you guys so much for listening.
Thanks.
And we'll see you next week.
Next
Peace
time.
Peace out.
Beep.
Woo.
Good job, Evan. We'll be right back. By the way, when I left, I actually went and pissed. Did you guys miss me? Did you guys want
to say anything? It was funny because what Sam was about to talk about, he's like, oh, I actually need Ben to talk about BRB or that.
Okay, so it totally happened.
But then I was like, well, just tell me what you know or whatever. And he kept going. And then by the time you got back, you picked it up anyway, so it's fine.
Right. In other words, nobody needs you anywhere at any time, so don't worry about it.
Oh, I wanted to say something about Mike and I forgot it.
Oops.
About the RAM cloud thing, Sam.
Mm-hmm.
You replied to me, you said, Ben, I want a RAM cloud now, or build me a RAM cloud.
No, dude, it was way funnier than that. I said, dear Ben, please give me a 64 terabyte RAM cloud for Christmas. Sincerely, Samuel.
Said, okay, it was way funnier. I guess it wasn't that funny because I would have told it better.
God, whatever.
But you didn't reply all to Mike Shaw.
Oh.
You just replied to me.
I assume that you replied to him.
No, I had to forward it to him just today because I just realized you didn't do that. So he'll be like, wow, this is like a month ago. I sent this email to thanks.
Whatever. If he's getting acknowledged, I'm sure he likes it. We give him a shout out, too.